Good morning, everyone. My name is David Nahai. I serve as the chair of the Los Angeles Regional Water Quality Control Board. Today is Thursday, February 26th. It is 9:08, and I'm calling this meeting to order. For people who only want to listen or watch the meeting, the board's customary webcast is available. There is a direct link to the webcast on the meeting agenda posted on our website. In addition, we're receiving presentations and public comments today through a Zoom meeting platform and in person. For this board meeting, Spanish interpretation services will not be available through the Zoom platform, and the in-person Spanish interpreters are not available today. Or are they available?
The webcasting hasn't started.
Okay, I'm going on what is before me. I'm going to continue. If we do have a Spanish interpreter available, we can perhaps access them later.
We do not have a Spanish interpreter today.
Okay. All right. Okay, so please note that for all Los Angeles Regional Water Quality Control Board meetings, there is no expectation of privacy regarding any communications. Meetings are recorded, and names of participants are listed in the Zoom forum. Participation in a recorded meeting will be deemed consent to be recorded. So now we'll move on to our roll call and a declaration of quorum. So I'll ask Ms. Helen Rowe for a roll call.
Vice Chair Ashion. Board Member Camacho.
Here.
Board Member Christensen.
Here.
Board Member Mendez.
Here.
Chair Nahai.
Here.
Roll call completed.
Thank you. And we do have a quorum present. So next we will move on to the order of the agenda. Note that agenda items are numbered for identification purposes only and may not necessarily be considered in this order. I'll ask our EO if there are any changes to the order of the agenda.
Chair, there are no changes to the order of the agenda. Thank you.
Thank you. Next item, item number three, is the approval of our draft meeting minutes for the December 18th, 2025 meeting. Do I have a motion for adoption of the meeting?
A motion to adopt.
Thank you. Motion from Board Member Camacho.
Second.
And a second from Board Member Christensen. Please call the roll.
Board Member Camacho.
Yes.
Board Member Christensen?
Yes.
Board Member Mendez?
Yes.
Chair Nahai?
Yes.
Motion carries. Thank you.
Thank you. Next item number four, is the selection of officers for calendar year 2026. And I will ask for nominations first for the position of chair, and then we'll go through that, and then for the position of vice chair. Could I have a nomination for chair, please?
Yes, I would like to renominate our current chair, Nahai. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. Thanks so much. Are there any other nominations for board members for the position of chair? Any other nominations? Okay. All right. Well, I'm hearing none, so I'll ask for a roll call vote for the chair position nomination.
Board Member Camacho?
Yes.
Board Member Christensen?
Yes.
Board Member Mendez?
Yes.
Chair Nahai?
I don't think it would be appropriate to.
Okay. Motion carries. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks very much. Next would be the nomination for the position of vice chair. Vice Chair Ashton is ill today and has lost her voice, and that's why she's not with us here today. But I would like to nominate her for the position of vice chair, and I'll pause to see if there are any other nominations for the position of vice chair. Hearing none, could I have a roll call for the position of vice chair, please?
Board Member Camacho?
Yes.
Board Member Christensen?
Yes.
Board Member Mendez? Chair Nahai.
Yes, indeed.
Motion carries. Thank you. Okay,
thank you. Thank you. And let me just take a moment to thank my fellow board members for renominating me for another a term as chair. I consider it a real privilege, and I consider the vote a vote of your trust in me. I think this will be my sixth term as chair of the regional ward. Not that I'm counting, mind you, but but it will be. And I have to say, you know, as you know, I've served with a number of different boards at the regional board and other places as well. And I in terms of the caliber, intelligence, dedication, professionalism of this board and the board members here, really, you're all second to none, second to none. And I'm very, very proud to serve with you, and very proud also to serve with not just our executive leadership, our EO, Susanna Arredondo, and our AEOs, Jenny Newman, Russ Colby, and the entire team at the Regional Water Board and the staff. It really is a point of great pride for me to be a part of this team. So thank you. Thank you. Okay, we'll move on next to board member communications. And I'm going to start to ask for ex parte disclosures from our board members. I'll start with board member Mendez.
None to report.
Board member Christensen?
None for me.
Board member Camacho?
None.
And, well, board member Ashton has lost her voice, so she wouldn't be able to tell us anything anyway, but I can assure you she didn't have any ex parte disclosures. So next we will move on to board member reports. And I will again start with board member Mendez.
No major report, but I did want to highlight something that I've been talking to the executive officer about regarding a recent action at the California Air Resources Board regarding artificial intelligence tools and public participation and the validity of those and how those were used in a recent board action. And perhaps if you can talk a little bit about the initiatives that the board is doing during her report to address some of these public participation issues, ensuring that the public is able to speak and we are able to validate their comments, and not ensuring that other vested interests or special interests are not using it in a perverse way. So there were, if you're not aware, last week there was an article in the Los Angeles Times regarding this artificial intelligence and public participation at the actually it was at the regional air board here in the South Coast region.
Okay, thank you for that. Board member Christensen?
Yes, thank you. Yeah, thank you for that. I missed that article. That's disturbing. A couple of things coming from my neck of the woods in wildfire and climate. I had the honor of serving on a panel for Conservation X Lab's recent prize for wildfire tech. And there's all this cool new remote sensing through satellites that looks at tracking fire behavior, can model how fire enters neighborhoods and moves through it. So it was just really amazing to see these advancements, and of course an honor to serve on that panel. And the panel that I served on was about scaling and how to scale tech. And I've noticed in the fire realm, it's a very top-down approach. Our firefighters, our fire agencies really set the bar and the plan for wildfire resilience. And of course, as they should, and they do a wonderful job with it. However, we know that wildfires are going to continue because of climate change. And even the best resourced fire agencies in the world, which are actually in California, luckily, you know, can't adopt enough tech to stay ahead of these things. And so I got a chance to talk about it there and a chance to talk about it here, that I think community engagement and community-led resilience is something that is only just now coming to the surface in the wildfire realm. You know, we all talk about community engagement in our work, in water, in environmentalism, and it just, it hasn't quite gotten the same attention yet. But I do think it's time, and all of us have, you know, a role and a responsibility and an interest, I think, to be the masters of our own property's destiny, right? So just a observation there. I also am going to be joining the Sierra Resource Conservation District's meeting where they're looking at research opportunities within their South Sierra Integrated Regional Water Management Plan. That meeting's coming up, haven't done it yet, but again, heartened to see that these agencies are looking at the multi-benefits and cross, you know, impacts of wildfire, different climate impacts, different lenses to use in their planning. So I will report back when I have that meeting. Thank you.
Perfect. Good stuff. Board Member Camacho.
Yes, and I did have the pleasure of attending on January 27th with the LA Regional Board staff, the first of a series of workshops surrounding recycled water as part of the LA County Water Plan. And so in this first workshop, we had participation from state board members as well, from DDW and from the state board strike team, as well as our regional board staff and the LA County Sanitation District, as well as LA City Sanitation District and water plant staff as well. And so these workshops are designed basically to create communication between all of the members that are going to be able to make recycled water work. And so a lot of the discussions are surrounding updates on the status of the projects, when the next big steps are going to be. There's a lot of discussion surrounding concentrate discharge and how to deal with that, and trying to look ahead to see what the potential pitfalls may be, and to have discussions and perhaps potential solutions very early on, and making everybody aware. And also getting a hold of or understanding the science behind a lot of the discussions that are happening surrounding permitting and those projects. And so these discussions, consortiums will continue to happen. I know that there's another number two that's going to be planned. And so I think that it was one of the outcomes of this is to really look at how the state board strike team is going to work with this consortium and all of these folks to really accelerate these projects that are coming down the line that we really do need to, you know, secure at least make our water supply here in Southern California more reliable. And so, more to come. Thank
Perfect.
You.
Thank you. Great work. And I've got one report. I gave a keynote address at the American Groundwater Trust Conference on the 19th. It was, and I mean the whole point of it was to talk about our groundwater resources, not just in our region. I talked about this globally, the state of California in terms of our progress with SGMA here, and then of course here for our region where groundwater is of such critical importance to us in terms of our water supply and what we're trying to do here in the San Fernando Valley and elsewhere in order to protect this priceless resource. They had, I think, about 150 people at the conference. They were pretty much all in the groundwater industry, and so it was actually a very engaged group, and I'm told that that the talk was well received. I was actually invited to do the keynote from a former regional board staff member, YR, who gave such impeccable service to this board over so many years, and it was good to see him again. He hadn't changed one iota in like 30 years since I've known him, but it was good to do that, and it was good to be able to spread the word about all of the work that we're doing on this board to protect the environment and our groundwater resources, especially in the face of all of the forces that try to erode environmental protection here in the state of California. The other thing that I wanted to just mention is that LADWP just came out with its draft urban water management plan. I would like at some point perhaps to ask DWP to come to us to talk about the components of that plan. Certainly wastewater recycling is part of it in terms of Pure Water LA, but also many other things in terms of our water supply here in this region for the future. So we should think about inviting them at some point. Okay. All right. Next item on the agenda is the executive officer's report, but we're not going to have a verbal report today.
Yes, I don't have a verbal report, but I did want to respond to Board Member Mendez's comment in regards to AI. So last year, State Board's IT established a working group to evaluate various tools that we have for AI, and also OCC's heavily involved as well in that working group to ensure that we have safeguards in place. And this also includes for public comment. So as more guidance comes down, I'll make sure to inform the board as well. So thank you, Board Member Mendez.
Okay, thank you. Thank you. Next is the update from our State Water Board liaison, Board Member Laurel Firestone. I hope is with us virtually.
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Welcome.
Great. Hi. Thanks for having me. And I wanted to start out today. I don't know if the clerk was able to get the slides that I had, but that would be great. So Board Member Camacho had asked that I present a little bit on a hydrologic update of where we are in hydrologic condition. So that was a fun assignment. We get these monthly. And I took a few of those slides and just want to share a brief overview. I will say this is, I'll share the sources of where I got this, but there's some great sources out there to get fun maps and up-to-date information and analysis that are really great. You can go to the next slide. So I wanted to start with just helping ground everyone, which I know most people know, but for the LA area, not only do we have, local sources, but there is a ton of imported water that the region relies on. And so when we do hydrologic updates, we're really getting a surface water hydrology, including snow, precip, reservoirs, and these sorts of watershed overviews. That's what I'm going to talk about. I wanted to highlight this map because it's nice to see the huge area of watersheds that when we look at water supply, we need to be looking at both in the state up north, the eastern Sierras and eastern side of the valley, as well as a huge Colorado River basin. So you can go to the next slide. So the main source of information, I would just encourage people that want to dig in on this, that's really excellent, is Weather West, which is a blog that Daniel Swain runs, and he has great blogs and visuals that he pulls together from lots of different sources. But this gives you a sense of where the snow water equivalent, which is really all the storage of water in snow, is looking at the major sources that serve the LA area. So again, that Northern California, Colorado Basin, Eastern Sierras. And what you can see is that a lot remains well below average nearly everywhere, except across the central and southern Sierra Nevada and California, and a little bit in the far northern Rockies. But it's record low snowpack across most of the West, despite a lot of recent rainfall. But as you can see, really, really low snowpack. And that's, of course, consistent with what we're expecting and seeing from climate change. If you go to the next slide. This gives you a sense of, and is a little bit out of date. It's not the most recent ones, but it's from November through January. And you can see the precipitation on the right and then temperature, mean temperature on the left. And so what you can see is that we, most of the West, most of the entire West experienced its warmest winter on record. And there was a mix of above and below average precip. So, you know, there's, as you all felt, there was some a lot of precip down in Southern California. But, you know, looking at that Colorado Basin, some of the driest on record. From a water supply standpoint and a water management standpoint, that's a challenge. All right, so go down to the next slide. If we zoom into California, we see similarly that actually the precip levels have been pretty good in California. We're actually above average for this time of year. So 116% of average in, you know, overall as a state, and you can see how that differs in different parts. But the actual precip levels have been good. The challenge is, of course, storing that and capturing that. And if we go down to the next slide. So we capture precip mostly in snowpack, but we also have a large reservoirs and large reservoir systems and canal systems that we store water in that is actually in really good shape right now. We've had some good years, and the reservoir levels are higher than average, actually 120% of average, but our snowpack is low. So it's only 61% of average. And you know, what you can see is in these years of where we can't capture where we're not capturing snow, or we have dry years, we have to rely on both our reservoirs as well as groundwater, of course. I don't have great slides on groundwater, and obviously groundwater is going to be very different locally from region to region, but I will say that overall, our groundwater, despite good, you know, you saw the precip levels, despite good precip levels, overall as a state, if their monitoring wells are still 25% below normal levels. So we have drained our aquifers overall so much that it just will take a very long time of very focused recharge to be able to get back to even normal levels. But we continue to rely on groundwater in dry years and, of course, above ground reservoirs. I did want to note that just for folks that want to dig in, since this is such a high level overview. In addition to Weather West, the California Water Watch website is excellent. That's really our state website, and you can drill in by zip code. It has lots of details, including on groundwater and reservoirs and all kinds of great things. So wanted to highlight that for folks that want to dig in. All right, if you go to the next slide, I just wanted to highlight that as there's a lot of folks that do forecasting, and this is a forecast of the next through the next late February and early March. We're expecting heat waves across the Southwest, and that isn't good for snowpack, or for if there is precipitation, for it to be stored in snowpack. It's more likely that it is going to be rain if it happens. And also, of course, heat exacerbates evapotranspiration. So that gives you a sense of just the types of information we get in our hydro update. You know, reemphasize, any local areas rely a lot on very localized and different sources. So this is a high level overview, but for each individual water system, they may get it just from groundwater from a few wells in very localized areas. They may use a combination of recycled water, reservoirs, storage. And then of course we're gonna hear an update on the stormwater capture work to try to capture more of that rainwater supply for local supplies as well as improving water quality. So I think that's it with the slides. I also just wanted to highlight a few things on my board liaison side. At the state board, just to give you a sense of things that we're up to, you all just had last month had your retreat and went over priorities for the year. We're kind of breaking this into different steps and are having a series of annual priorities discussions starting February, March, and April. We've been doing a ton of work on trying to get an update to the Bay Delta Plan. I'll note just for this region, that will govern a lot of the water supply that comes to this region from the state water project, so from that Northern California area. So it's very relevant to this region. But we've proposed a second draft and an analysis of impacts in our staff report, and are really pushing to try to adopt a final by the end of this year. We're continuing to make progress the agricultural expert panel is continuing to make progress. We're expecting a draft report for public comment any day now. And then the plan is to have a final and a presentation by the chair of that panel on their recommendations. And I know that will be really relevant to all the regions. So we'll be sharing information on that once it's final. Other things I wanted to highlight are there's a number of vapor intrusion workshops. I know that's really important for the LA region in terms of cleaning up contaminated sites to be able to use. A number of the first two workshops actually already happened, but there's two more. They're by Zoom, and I would just encourage folks to go to our website, and you can Google State Water Board's vapor intrusion website for more information. Other things I wanted to mention is we have a our drinking water regulatory priorities. We do an annual overview of what those are and what to expect and kind of coming down the pipe. That is coming for discussion on our Tuesday board meeting coming up. Also, I think I mentioned this, but just to reiterate on Prop 4, you may remember we adopted emergency regs for the water recycling funding for Prop 4 in late January. We also have since then put out draft guidelines for the Prop 4 border funding. And lastly, one of the things we have coming up, not at our next Tuesday board meeting, but at the board meeting after that, so the second mid-March board meeting, is some proposed allocations from our cleanup and abatement account. This is the account of penalties and fines from enforcement orders across the state that goes into our cleanup and abatement account. We use that for emergencies and for different cleanup projects, and we've had some challenges in clarity on accounting because it's a clearing house, it's a clearing account that I don't totally understand. But we have a better sense now in terms of a more real-time accounting that lets us be able to manage that a little bit better. And we have two proposals for that funding. One is to provide some money back to regions. And we have a proposal that incorporates some base amount for all regions, but then an amount based on relative to the amount of fines that different regions contributed to the account. So it's sort of balancing and giving back funding in a more equitable way that still ensures every region has access to some funding. That's really at the region's discretion and is meant to support a lot of the discretionary contracts that were cut just recently in the budget that affected a lot of really critical work that the regions were in the middle of. But also is kind of a model for potential future allocations and how we might balance getting money back to the regions. For the first time, we would do a $5 million kind of pilot pot for environmental justice and tribal projects. And, you know, that's limited in terms of having to address cleanup of waste in some way, but it could be used for things like also water quality monitoring and assessment. It could be used for cleanup. It could be used for things like community, like tribal beneficial use, data collection, and different analyses. So, more info on that, but I just wanted to mention it because I know I've mentioned that to this group over the years, that we finally have that coming to the board for a vote at the State Water Board, not this next meeting, but the mid-March meeting. And that's my report. Happy to answer questions.
Well, thank you very much. As always, a very, very comprehensive report. So I'll ask if board members have questions. I think Board Member Mendez.
Sure. Thank you, Board Member Firestone. I appreciate the broad overview on the water trends statewide. That's quite informative. I was most interested in the cleanup and abatement proposals that you had for fines and penalties. I'm excited that there's been proposals for a base amount to go to all regional boards, but also to include some equity metrics to ensure that communities that are most disproportionately impacted from these fines and discharges have a higher opportunity to get additional funds to address those issues. And just please let us know, and I hope you reach out to other regional boards of how we can be of support, because I definitely think this is an issue that would help with our region, both here in LA County and Ventura County, to address some of these disproportionate discharges and exposures. So thank you for the work you've been leading on this. I know this has been at least 5 years in the making or so, so I appreciate the hard work that you're doing. I know it's a heavy lift.
Thanks.
No, Board Member Camacho.
Yes, and I want to thank Board Member Firestone for providing the presentation on what our hydro outlook was going to be. And I guess my takeaway from that is that many times when we see a lot of rain coming in, we think everything is A-OK. And looking at the prognosis here, that it's not. We're still having storage issues with our snowpack, and we need to continue with a lot of the resilience measures. Conservation is key to all of this, as well as the many recycled water projects that are moving forward as well. So thank you very much.
Board Member Kirsten.
Thank you. Hi, Board Member Firestone. Nice to see you, and echoing my fellow board members in thanking you for your presentation on our hydrological outlook. Agreed that it's quite dire, and always upsetting to see those maps and those numbers. And I, obviously, to echo Board Member Camacho on the troubles that we have with capturing, you know, these wettest years where we're getting far more rain than we're used to, and it ends up flowing out to the ocean because we don't have the infrastructure to store it. Water recycling, conservation, all of that is key. And I would also hope that the state and other agencies are looking at building new massive pieces of storage infrastructure in the region. And I'm wondering if you have information about that and can maybe speak to that.
Yeah, actually, I'll just mention that this was, I think it was yesterday, that there was an announcement about the new state water plan that's being developed. So the governor, there was legislation that was passed last year, and the state is kind of revamping how it does the California water plan to have a numeric target of how of water supply, but also be looking at that holistically and in a more ambitious strategic way to really measure how are we capturing water more strategically in the face of these changes in climate change. So right now, pending before us, and I you know, subject to ex parte requirements, we have two new storage and conveyance facilities, Sites Reservoir and the Delta Conveyance project are both up in the application process for their water rights. And so we're actively considering those this year. But I think really importantly, as we look at the volumes of water, it's really groundwater storage that is critical. And that, you know, we need everything. We need a full portfolio. We need water recycling. We need stormwater capture in general in urban areas. We need conservation. We need to be able to protect the quality of the water that we have. But more strategically, being able to really capture precip back into recharge in the ground at scale is something that I know is a major, major focus of the Department of Water Resources and the state as we're trying to put together a portfolio for how we can, you know, change how we manage water. We're used to being able to have water stored as snow, and we can't rely on that in the same way anymore. And so we need to be looking at how to capture precip, which, as you saw, is higher than average. But if we're not able to capture it, we can't access it for human uses. And lastly, I'll just say, you know, the challenge with all of this is we're also having to, of course, manage really severe ecosystem decline at the same time as we're trying to enhance storage and supply resiliency. So what we're considering from our regulatory side, it's in the Bay Delta plan, ensuring that a base amount of water continues to go to the ocean, because rivers flow into the ocean. That's what a delta is. It's that connection. And so the ecosystems need water. We need to have water in our rivers. We can't just store it all in reservoirs or underground. To make sure we're protecting those ecosystems. And so we're trying to have a more clear framework for ensuring that there's still protection for a base amount of flow for ecosystem needs, just as at the same time as helping transition our water supply, capture, and management systems.
That's really good to hear. I definitely, it is the era of multi-benefit, and so I'm glad there's such a holistic approach. And it sounds like at the end of the day, we need a lot less concrete covering our ground and our ability to absorb the water. But that is it for me. Thank you.
Thank you. First I want to applaud your the work that you're doing on the cleanup and abatement account. Thank you for that. But also, you mentioned vapor intrusion workshops, and I wonder if you could elaborate a little bit. Is it intended mostly for property owners who have contaminated properties? Do you expect it to be a lot of consultants that will attend those workshops, and will part of the workshop talk about funding opportunities?
That's a good question. Let me see if I have quick answers or not. I think it is. There's a number of cleanup case basic training and vapor intrusion in the community workshops. So I'm looking to see if I can get a sense of the answer to your question on who may be best as an audience. I think it's really both. My sense is it's both consultants as well as community in terms of understanding the basics, how we look at best practices, path to closure and decision making and data out there. So it's not maybe, it's probably more than, you know, your average person that isn't super engaged in vapor intrusion wants to know, but it is open to sort of a variety of folks that are experts as well as like relatively new, but getting engaged in this area and wanting to really dig in to understand. I think that the usefulness of this is understanding we have so many multiple agencies at the Cali PA level with regional water boards, our DTSC, the state water board. DTSC is the Department of Toxic Substances Control. And then we have our environmental health hazard assessment. And so what this is trying to do is bring together an overview of how we're all working together at the state and regional levels, and ultimately get to a place where we can update our vapor. There's continues to be some needs to improve clarity with vapor intrusion standards across different agencies and jurisdictions. So I think it's helping to bring sort of the full community along with that decision making in a more comprehensive way.
Yeah, thank you. And here in the LA region, we also have the Los Angeles County Fire Department, which in addition to the regional board and DTSC handles a lot of contamination cases as well. So you know, that's very, very welcome work. And I think hopefully it'll help clear up, I think, a lot of confusion, certainly with property owners as to how to deal with contamination on their sites. So thanks very much. Thank you. And thank you for answering all of our questions and giving such a great broad report. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Okay. All right. Next, we're going to move on to public forum. So this is item 8 on the agenda. Thank you, Heather. So any person may address the board regarding any matter within the board's jurisdiction, provided the matter does not appear elsewhere on this agenda, has not been scheduled to appear on a future agenda, and is not expected to be imminently scheduled for the board's consideration. So each speaker will have 3 minutes to address the board unless additional time was approved in advance. Please note that comments during public forum should be on items that are not pending or scheduled to appear on a future agenda and which are not otherwise on today's agenda. So in terms of the order of speakers, we'll first hear from speakers who are here in person. Then we will hear from those who are attending remotely, who've registered in advance. And next, we will hear from other remote speakers. And after the speakers who are registered in advance are called, I will ask any other persons desiring to speak to raise their Zoom hands so that our staff can pick them up. So in terms of speakers in person, I'm going to call first on Council Member Tony Tremblay from the City of Camarillo for 3 minutes. Thank you so much for being here.
Good morning, Mr. Chair.
Good morning.
Phone. There we go. Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the board. It's a pleasure to be in front of you. I'm appearing on behalf of the City of Camarillo. I'm privileged to be in my 10th year on the City Council, and I've twice served as mayor. I want to speak directly to the Cayagas Creek Watershed Salts TMDL and some litigation that is a direct threat to your board's TMDL that was issued through the Basin Plan, as I understand it, in 2014. Camarillo has lived the reality of the problems that your board is trying to address through that Salts TMDL. Beginning in the 1990s, the salts that were flowing into the Pleasant Valley groundwater basin and mounding under Camarillo impacted our city's longstanding groundwater wells. And it was to the point that the groundwater could no longer meet drinking standards. We had to stop using one of our long-term wells for anything other than emergency use. And as a result, Camarillo had to buy and use more state water project water, and the supply of that keeps getting less reliable and more expensive. And while it hasn't been easy, Camarillo, through the assistance of its own ratepayers and state and federal authorities, put together and implemented a $70 million groundwater desalter, which directly addresses the salts DMDL, and it was only possible because of a allocation provided by the Fox Canyon Groundwater Management Agency in 2016 for 4,500 acre feet a year. So our view of the desalter project is that it's a win-win. We're removing more salts than anyone else in our watershed, and we also recapture a part of our historic groundwater supply, and we don't have to buy that water from the state. So here's the issue. The plan is at risk because of a water rights litigation filed in 2021 by a group of mostly Oxnard agribusinesses that are calling themselves the OPV Coalition. They are challenging the allocation ordinance of the Fox Canyon Groundwater Management Agency, and they've sued all the groundwater users in the two basins. Last year, the Santa Barbara Superior Court scheduled a trial to decide the total and safe yields of the Oxnard and Pleasant Valley basins. We were shocked by the result of phase one of this trial, which failed to recognize that there isn't enough groundwater in the Pleasant Valley Basin to ensure that we can keep using our desalter in the manner in which it was intended. We went to trial alone against many other parties, most of the other parties in the case. But here's the 4 points that I would like to leave with you. Number one, the other parties convinced the judge not even to hear our evidence about your salts TMDL, the impacts of salty inflows on our municipal supplies and our desalter. Number two, because the judge did not have the benefit of this important evidence, we are appealing the final judgment in phase one due to our concern that that decision is going to strand at least a significant portion of our desalter. And in the appeal, we have filed a request for judicial notice with the Court of Appeal, so the Salts TMDL is in front of the Court of Appeal. Thirdly, the result would be very bad not only for Camarillo's water supplies, but also for real-world implementation of the Salts TMDL. Who else would build a facility to offer more facilities to implement these TMDLs. So here's our ask. Our ask is that you request or that you consider how this litigation may upend the goals of your SALTS TMDL and consider filing an amicus brief in the Court of Appeal, supporting the ability of the judge to hear the evidence related to the TMDL. I'm happy to discuss this with your legal counsel further and staff. I've left our contact information with the executive officer, and I appreciate very much your time.
Yep, thank you. Thank you for talking to us about this. So why is it that the judge wouldn't consider the SALTS TMDL? Was it not adequately brought to the attention of the court, or what do you think?
Mr. Chair, we went to great lengths. Our trial counsel went to great lengths to bring it to the attention of the court. I cannot discern why it was the other parties opposed it, and it was critical, relevant evidence for purposes of phase one of the trial, because phase one of the trial dealt with water right or dealt with determining the safe yield and native safe yield. And we believe the court needed that information. It was highly relevant. I cannot tell you why the judge said, no, I'm not going to consider it. She said, I'm not going to consider it.
Okay.
And we think it's highly relevant. And we want to, you know, we're implementing that TMDL. It's extremely important from a water quality standpoint. And our desalter is a win-win. We're concerned that we spent $70 million of our money and state and federal money, and it's a highly successful project. It's a win-win. This litigation could ultimately upend that entire effort. So we respectfully request that you consider filing an amicus with the Court of Appeal. Our opening brief in the appeal was filed just yesterday.
So right, well, thank you. As a state agency, I don't know what would go into that consideration, but I want to thank you for it, and I'm sure that we will discuss it internally with our counsel and with state authorities and see what, if anything, can be done. But thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the board. We would be delighted to. We would be very happy to speak with staff and legal counsel further.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Okay, our next speaker, who's here in person, I'll call on Italia Salvaje of Bayona Wetlands Land Trust for 3 minutes. Thank you for coming.
Thank you. Good morning, board members, and congratulations to the calendar year 2026 board officers. My name is Italia Salvaje, and I'm speaking on behalf of the Bayona Wetlands Land Trust. I attended October's meeting and expressed my hope for a TMDL schedule with measurable milestones to address and track the progress of invasive vegetation removal at the Bayona Wetlands Bayona Wetlands Ecological Reserve. I am proud to be a part of the collaboration between the California Department of Fish and Wildlife and our team, a collaboration that has been taking place since July of 2024 and has resulted in successful community-based restoration efforts in Area A that take place on the second and fourth Saturday of the month from 9 to 11. And I'm here today to express my ongoing hope for a TMDL schedule to address and track the progress of invasive vegetation removal at the reserve. My team is committed to ensuring our collaborative efforts with the California Department of Fish and Wildlife help meet the milestones of the TMDL schedule I hope you implement. I request the board to act on this request today, and thank you for your consideration.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Now, if there's a...
Yes, thank you for your participation here today, and I know, was it last in January or was it December, we did have an informational item on the progress with the Department of Fish and Wildlife, and at that meeting we also discussed about having a follow-up meeting between some of the key principals from our agency and possibly the board and vice chair. I was just wondering if there's any update on that pending meeting.
All right, thank you. I'll move on to our next in-person.
Chair Nahai?
Yes.
We could, staff could provide an update right now if you like.
Sure, let's do it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thanks, Board Member Mendez, Jenny Newman. We have been meeting with the staff from California Department of Fish and Wildlife, who presented in December, and we are also working on the letter that the board directed us to write to compel faster implementation of the TMDL, and we are we're working on it, and we'll be setting up that meeting with probably the director of Fish and Wildlife and our chair and executive officer, and then following up perhaps with the secretaries.
Great. Thank you. That's wonderful news. Again, understanding that the Department of Fish and Wildlife is our sister or brother organization. So we're trying to work in a collegial manner to get that done. So I appreciate the update. Thank you.
Great. Thank you for that. Any other? Okay. Great. Moving on, our next speaker will be Ray Tahir from the TECS Environmental for 4 minutes.
Good morning, everyone. I have a presentation. Next slide, please. I've not gotten a response from the board regarding issues that were raised in the administrative petition challenging the non-point source trash TMDL order, including, one, there's no evidence that parks, golf courses, and recreation areas adjacent to water bodies discharge trash to these water bodies. Chair Nahai has used his opinion as evidence that the order is needed based on his observation of trash in LA streets. Streets, by the way, are not a point source. Board members should visit these green sites to see for themselves if trash is a problem. Secondly, the bulk of non-point source trash comes from the city of LA, discharged to the LA River and Biona Creek from homeless encampments, which are considered non-point sources. Third, the order requires compliance with Water Code 13241, water quality objectives, despite the fact that the order is not subject to this provision. 13241 requires compliance with its requirements only when it is proposed for inclusion in a water quality control plan, in this case, Basin Plan Chapter 3, Water Quality Objectives. Non-point source trash TMDLs are not mentioned at all in Chapter 3. 13241 says each regional board shall establish such water quality objectives in water quality control plans. I'm surprised that Mr. Nahai, along with Assistant EO Newman and Ms. Nunez, are not aware of this basic, well-known Wade Water Code requirement. It has been established by the courts, by the way. Fourth, the order applies to Arcadia, El Monte, Irwindale, Rosemead, Monrovia, and Montebello, all of which are in Reach 2 and or Reach 3 of the Rio Hondo, a LA River tributary. These reaches are not 303D listed for non-point source trash. Only Reach 1 of the Rio Hondo is listed. And this could be verified by looking at Appendix A of the 2024 Integrated Report. It is recommended, therefore, that the board schedule a workshop to allow discussion of these issues. Next slide, please. Oh, no, I'm sorry. We're good. Back up. There's also been no response to my request to conduct monitoring for BTEX and other toxic constituents in soil that could pose a threat to groundwater. I made these requests at the May 25th and December 2025 meetings, and in a letter to Chair Nahai dated February 9th, 2026. I referenced an LA Times article that said, water utilities in both the Eaton and Palisades fire burn scar areas have reported detecting carcinogen benzenes in parts of the water systems. Although monitoring was conducted in the Eaton Wash for a variety of constituents, it was limited to surface water testing, not subsurface soil testing. I was particularly concerned about a Chevron station in Altadena that was destroyed by fire and could have caused the underground storage tanks to leak BTEX into the subsurface. Next slide, please. As you can see at the top, you have the Chevron station before the fire, and next to it, you have the gas station after the fire. And the illustration below shows a potential for any leaking underground storage tanks for reaching the water table that could cause groundwater contamination. Next slide, please. Therefore, could Chair Nahai direct staff to do subsurface soil testing to determine if BTEX is contaminated? If there's a reason for not doing this, could you please explain? Lastly, I volunteered to be on the legal subcommittees but was refused. There's no legal reason for not allowing me to participate given the current mistakes that were made with the CII permit and the non-point source trash order and the current MS4 permit. I think my participation would be most helpful in getting the board and making sound regulatory decisions. It has been my experience that most lawyers are not well informed with federal and state regulations and other requirements, such as state board water quality orders and case law relative to permitting NTM deals, nor are they familiar with the technical side of these matters. You will need my help in these areas, especially given that Ivar Ridgway has retired and that the MS4 program is up for reissuance starting in a few weeks. One final thing, why wasn't Mr. Ridgway, who was employed with the regional board for over 20 years and developed the stormwater program, was not acknowledged for his service? The same could be with respect to Dr. LB Nye. Not doing so has a negative effect on staff morale, which I believe is at a low ebb. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you for your presentation. Okay, I'm going to move on now to, the next in-person presentation will be from LA County Public Works. I have two speakers, Jolene Verdiner and Hannah, looks like Dewey, could be Dury. I'm sorry, I can't read the handwriting, for 10 minutes.
Hi, good morning, Chair Nahai and members of the board. My name is Hannah Dewey. I'm the Assistant Deputy Director with LA County Public Works, overseeing the Stormwater Quality Division. You probably are familiar with some of my predecessors, which include Mark Lombos and most recently Jolene Guerrero. I am now in charge of the group responsible for implementing the suite of projects that are aiming us towards compliance. And prior to this role, I actually had experience on the project management side, and I was responsible for delivering and constructing several of these stormwater capture projects. So I hope to be seeing more of you all in the coming years and months, and really looking forward to working more collaboratively with you all on continuing to protect our precious water resources. So I'll now hand it off to Jelaine, who's going to be doing our presentation.
Good morning. As Hannah mentioned, my name is Jelaine Verdiner. I'm a principal engineer with LA County Public Works. And as she mentioned, our team is responsible for compliance with the MS4 permit, and we appreciate the opportunity to talk with you today and share my presentation. Next slide, please. So here are some of the topics we'll be sharing today. First, we'll go over a mention of the Regional Board's January retreat, some of our program highlights. We'll have a discussion of our investment in water quality, our external funding sources, an overview of our unincorporated area stormwater program, a quick mention of some of our project highlights, which some of you may have heard already in the past, and wrap up with some of our continuing efforts. Next slide. So Public Works listened to the board members' priorities shared during last month's retreat, and we fully support the regional board's efforts to address water quality. We noted your staff's comments regarding the extensive response to the devastating Palisades and Eaton fires. As you are aware, regional board staff assisted with expedited permits that enabled Public Works and other state and federal agencies to rapidly contain fire debris and prepare for increased sediment and debris that would otherwise have impacted our waterways after the first significant rains. Here we have some before and after photos of a debris basin located in the Palisades area that was filled during one such storm event and cleaned just 3 days later. So this is on January 27th, a picture of Cloudcroft debris basin. And if you go to the next slide, you can see that just 3 days later, it was completely removed. In the previous slide, the debris filled the outlet tower up to that that platform you see there on the right. Board staff also performed shoreline monitoring along with the Department of Public Health, which kept the public informed. And as you are aware from the Eaton Fire, which many of you joined us on, the county, along with assistance from the Office of Emergency Services, deployed a tremendous amount of BMPs aimed to protect our watersheds. So Public Works greatly appreciates the coordinated and very cooperative response to the fires and the valuable assistance of your staff. Next slide. So Public Works leads the UA stormwater program for the county with a primary focus on complying with federal and state stormwater quality regulations and improving the quality of stormwater runoff. Beyond these main goals, the program offers additional benefits such as boosting water supply through infiltration, creating more green spaces and open areas, and enhancing above-ground amenities to help address climate change. Our projects also contribute by providing educational opportunities and creating local jobs and making a positive impact on both the environment and the local community. Since the inception of the 2012 MS4 permit, the county has led the way with significant investments of time and money. These investments go beyond the large-scale projects we build and include some of these bulleted items you see here before you, which I'll dive into a little more in some of my upcoming slides. Next slide, please. So total program expenditures. The county and flood control district have been spending on average approximately $174 million each year on implementing MS4 permit goals, with recent highs in the last two fiscal years within the $200 million range, as you can see in the last two bar charts there. Next slide. The county and flood control district have consistently pursued external funding and have received the following amounts since 2015, totaling over $160 million. These amounts include $25 million in state grants, $105 million in Safe Clean Water Program regional funding for each of the fiscal years shown there, and $30 million in Caltrans contributions, which have supported projects such as a venture park and a laundry park. We also actively pursue more state grants, federal earmark funding, and additional Safe Clean Water Program funds, which help with operations and maintenance of our completed projects. Additionally, we continue to strengthen our partnership with Caltrans, which has allocated another $30 million for projects like Bassett High School, which is currently in design. Next slide. The UA Stormwater Program is fully behind several important LA County Board of Supervisors and countywide programs and initiatives that prioritize sustainability, resilience, and addressing climate change. These include, and links are included here for your use, our county sustainability plan, the LA County Water Plan, the Safe Clean Water Program, and as well, the latest board motion by LA County Board of Supervisors aimed at building climate-ready communities and infrastructure across Los Angeles County. Next slide. We also have ongoing investments in two major programs. We run the Clean LA and Water for LA programs. Through Clean LA, individuals and organizations gain access to an array of environmental programs pertaining to cultivating environmental sustainability. These programs cover a spectrum of topics, including solid waste management, industrial waste permitting, construction and demolition debris, stormwater management, what to do with used motor oil, household hazardous waste, public education, and much more. Water for LA is a program intended to transform LA County residents from passive water users to empowered and informed water advocates. As a trusted resource on all things water, Water for LA leads campaigns that educate the public and foster more sustainable behavior to help ensure a more resilient future. Next slide. Here are some photos of our amazing team at various outreach events, ranging from Parks After Dark events hosted by LA County Parks and Rec, classroom presentations, LA Dodger games related events, and meetings hosted by various community-based organizations. Next slide. The County Low Impact Development Standards Manual dates back to 2014, and a new draft has just recently been updated. Since 2021, approximately $200,000 has been spent towards this effort to update and implement the requirements in the manual, and continued investment has led to over 450 priority projects completed with over 86 acre-feet of storage capacity created. Next slide. Street sweeping occurs all throughout Los Angeles County and is one of our primary minimum control measures to help reduce pollutant loading from entering storm drain infrastructure and major waterways. In many areas throughout the county, we exceed the minimum frequency specified by the MS4 permit. With a cost of approximately $14 million per year, we are able to remove 180 pounds worth of street solids per curb mile. Next slide. Full capture devices. Meeting the trash TMDL final deadlines was a major accomplishment, retrofitting over 7,000 catch basins within the unincorporated county area. Over $5.2 million has been spent to retrofit our infrastructure, with another $800,000 spent annually to maintain, although we are noticing major increases in this amount needed for the O&M effort. Next slide. Monitoring is a large part of our program. As we continue to operate and maintain monitoring stations across all of our watersheds, we investigate BMP effectiveness, and we participate in various studies on behalf of unincorporated areas and the Flood Control District. Next slide. The county is tasked with constructing an estimated $3 billion worth of projects to comply with the TMDL requirements. These large-scale investments play a crucial role in achieving long-term water quality improvements across the region, and we have been proud to bring our projects to the communities and improve lives while protecting water quality. Here you see some of our projects that have been completed, and I'll quickly go over some of them. I know I'm running out of time. Next slide. Okay, Roosevelt. You can just keep going. East L.A., East LA was completed in 2021. Fantastic collaboration with local communities. Next slide, Urban Magic Johnson. Next project, Adventure Park, which my colleague Lee Alexanderson will touch on in his presentation later today. This was our first project that utilized diversion. Bassett High School, next slide, is a great example of a multi-benefit project in partnership with multiple agencies, including the Bassett Unified School District. It's currently in design with an estimated project cost of $126 million, one of our largest projects to date. Next slide. The Bionic Creek Trash Interceptor. I'm not sure how familiar some of you are with this, but this is yet another innovative effort to reduce pollutants from reaching our ocean. It's a solar-powered trash collection system designed to capture floating plastic, litter, and debris before it reaches the ocean. Developed by the Ocean Cleanup, the interceptor uses floating booms to guide trash towards the front of the device, where a conveyor belt automatically removes it from the water. So this system operates with two booms, as you see at the top.
Thank you.
Right?
Do you have a lot more?
No, one slide after this.
Okay, that's...
Okay. During dry weather, it alternates between two boom and one boom. So in conclusion, while we're making steady progress in capturing, treating, and diverting stormwater, modeling shows that meeting water quality standards depends on completing all of the projects in the WIMPs. Based on our experience implementing the MS4 permit so far, we will need more time and resources. We are seeing the benefits of improved water quality. However, projects are becoming more expensive.
I'm sorry. Now you're getting into an area asking for more time and so on, and you're well over the allocated time, Ms. Herlier. It's not fair to the board to do that. If that was the ask, I think we should have started with that to begin with.
Understood. We just hope you recognize the effort that we're making, and I'd be happy to share more information on any of the projects we've completed thus far.
Well, thank you, and we look forward to another presentation when we can have the time allocated, adhered to, so that we can hear what it is that you're actually are wanting, which as I hear is more time on compliance with MS4. I think the work that you've done is absolutely laudable. And I think the county does so much that others should emulate. Nevertheless, this conversation that you actually want to have, I think, requires a longer time to discuss.
Thank you.
Which I don't think we have time for today.
Okay. Well, we will be coming back with more project updates.
All right. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And Ms. Dewey, congratulations on your new position. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Tracy, did you have something to add to all this?
Nothing, Chair Nahai. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Agoscu.
Thank you all.
Are there any, before you leave, were there any questions?
Yeah, I was just wondering if the slide deck could be sent to all of the regional board members.
Sure.
That would be great. And again, congratulations on your new positions, a real change of the guard, right?
Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you all.
Any response from staff? Okay, I'm assuming that there are ongoing conversations with the county about...
Yes, staff meets regularly with the county every other month to talk about MS4 compliance issues, MS4 implementation projects, TMDLs, all sorts of things.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much. All right. I'm going now to move to the speakers that we have who are going to join us virtually. And I will call first on Walter Lamb from the Bayona Wetlands Land Trust for 3 minutes, please.
Thank you, Chair Nahai and board members. I do believe there's a single slide that I submitted. And the slide, while we wait for it to come up, is the written executive officer's report, some language from the written executive officer's report. And we sort of read this as an exclamation point to, you know, the discussion that's been happening now for 3 years and 3 months, which is, should we or should we not have an official TMDL implementation plan and schedule incorporated into the basin plan? And I just highlighted a few parts of this because it's clear that the board would like to see things move more quickly. That seems to be the whole purpose of writing a letter. Schedules are typically what people adopt to make sure that things are either moving according to a set timeline. And so it remains confusing to us why the board is averse to creating a schedule. Just to point out a couple other points here. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, I think, would come to a meeting if you asked, and they could give you an update on the federal environmental impact statement, which is a much, much bigger obstacle. Our understanding is that California Department of Fish and Wildlife hopes to finally recirculate a revised EIR in May. If they do that, it will be 2 years later than their original post-litigation assessment. And our concern is that these things that, and originally people think it's going to take 5 months, and instead it takes 2.5 years, and then you apply that down the road, and that you're flying blind because you don't have a schedule. And this project seems to be screaming out for a schedule. Also, LA County Public Works is actually an intermediary agency that needs to be part of the process of even getting the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers the information that it would need to resume work on an EIS. And I understand that sometimes it may seem like, oh, well, if it's the county or if it's the federal government, we don't need to worry about it. TMDLs, if there's a federal obstacle or a county obstacle or any kind of obstacle, having that in a schedule so that it's visible to everybody, we're all on the same page, we can track progress, if it still needs to be done, right? Even if the Department of Fish and Wildlife were to say, oh, don't worry about that, that's the Corps' responsibility, you do still need to worry about that because the TMDLs can't be implemented without it. I really am not somebody, I know you only know me through our interactions in these meetings, in which case I'm always advocating for this, but I really don't like ultimatums or anything. But I think at the end of 3 years and 3 months of talking about this, I think we probably agree that something different needs to happen, right? Nothing's going to happen by more discussion. And so, unfortunately, we are at that stage. I hope that today you will just look at your staff and say, hey, let's just create a schedule. Let's just do it. I don't see there's any downside to it. I don't know why you're adverse to it. So that's my hope, but we do need to take this to the next step. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you. Are there any questions for Ms. Salam or any staff response at this point? All right. Thank you very much. Our next virtual speaker is Simbre Magana from CDFW for 3 minutes. Yes, no?
Simbre is online, if you can unmute yourself.
All right, well, I'll move on to another speaker, and then perhaps we can access Ms. Magana later on. So the next speaker virtually is Candice Dickens-Russell from FOLA.
She's not online. Sharon, hi.
Okay. All right, so we'll move next to Ms. Gabrielle Crow from the Gabrielino Shoshone Nation.
Miha, Tehovetamet Nahinkam, Natwanine Gabriel Rocha Crow. Hello and good day, relatives. My name is Gabrielle Rocha Crow. I am the co-chair and secretary of environmental sciences for the Gabrielino Shoshone Nation. I'm also a cultural and environmental education consultant with the Biona Wetlands Trust. I am here this morning to uplift and support the words of my colleague, Ms. Salvaje. Over the past few years, I've been very grateful to collaborate with the California Department of Fish and Wildlife to be able to work on minor restoration of Area A of the Biona Wetlands Ecological Reserve by removing invasive species of vegetation. Biona Wetlands is a place of cultural significance for my people and more personally for my family. Specifically, my grandmother battled to preserve the wetlands in the 1980s, and now it's my duty and responsibility to continue that legacy. Transparency with the TMDL targets over time, as well as better engagement with tribes, will increase trust with this project, that this project will be on track to remove invasive species from the Biona Wetlands and provide a more beautiful environment for our plant and animal relatives, as well as a place for students and the public to learn about the cultural significance. I'm happy to hear that you'll continue to move forward with working with CDFW to provide a better timeline to achieve these goals. Oishkonaha, thank you.
Thank you very much. Thanks so much for that. So anybody else in wishing to speak virtually?
I see Ms. Annalisa Moe online.
All right. Okay, so then let's hear from Ms. Annalisa Moe from Gila Bay.
I see Annalisa, well, I think Annalisa's here for item 2, maybe not public forum. Or item 10, sorry.
All right. Is Ms. Magana on or Ms. Dickens-Russell? Either one?
Magana's on, but muted.
Okay. Can we ask her please to unmute herself so we can hear?
She's unmuted now.
I actually don't have anything to say at this time. I took my comfort call just to be
I'm sorry. Hang on, please. I can't distinguish anything that's being said. Can we improve the sound quality somehow?
No, I do. I've been hearing it. I'm anyway, I just put the comment in there with what I wanted to say that came up inadvertently, but I don't really have a time for Fish and Wildlife Office.
I'm sorry. I apologize. This is not working.
Chair Nahai, I think I could translate. I believe she said that she's available for questions, but didn't have anything to say. But I'm not clear what she's available for questions on.
Well, I mean, we can pose questions, but we wouldn't be able to hear what the answers are. So I think if we could, let's please ask Ms. Magana to perhaps attend the next meeting when we can have questions and actually receive answers from her? Okay. All right, let's do that. Well, thank you very, very much for participating today, and we look forward to hearing from you at our next meeting, hopefully. So next, there are no other Zoom hands up? Nobody else?
That's all we have.
Okay, thank you. Next, we'll move on to our uncontested items calendar. After that, we'll take a 5-minute break and then move on to our presentation. So, uncontested items, we have one. It's item number 9. And this is consideration of tentative waste discharge requirements for the Southern California Gas Company Pipeline Safety Enhancement Program, line 1004, phase 1B. It's a pipeline replacement project. So if there are no questions about it, if nobody wants to remove this from the uncontested items calendar, I'll ask for a motion.
So moved.
Who moved? Okay. Moved by Board Member Christensen.
And I'll second.
Seconded by Board Member Camacho. Could we have the roll call, please, Ms. Rowe?
Board Member Camacho?
Yes.
Board Member Christensen?
Yes.
Board Member Mendez?
Yes.
Chair Nahai?
Yes.
Motion carries. Thank you.
Thank you. So if you like, let's take a 5-minute break. Okay? 5 minutes. We'll be back. It's now... It's now 10:35 exactly. Let's return at 10:40. Okay, let's resume. So our next item is the first of our two information items today. This is item 10, and it is an update on the Safe Clean Water Program biennial report. And we'll hear from staff from the Los Angeles County Safe Clean Water Program, and staff will present a summary of recommendations from the draft 2026 biennial report. So, staff introduction, Ms. Newman.
I just wanted to remind the board this was at the request of the board to hear about the draft biennial report, and so we invited the county to make this presentation. And Lee Alexander is going to make the presentation. Thank you for coming, Lee.
Okay, Mr. Anderson, Alexanderson, thank you so much for being here and looking forward to your presentation.
Yeah. Good morning, Chair, members of the board. Appreciate the invitation to speak here again. Lee Alexanderson with LA County Public Works. I'm a principal engineer. The teams I lead oversee the LA County Water Plan, the Safe Clean Water Program, and other long-term strategic initiatives for the Flood Control District. Before I start, I just want to give a couple acknowledgments. Thank you to Board Member Camacho, and who's also a Regional Oversight Committee member of the Safe Clean Water Program, for her participation in developing the biennial progress report. And then also, thank you to Assistant Executive Officer Jenny Newman for her efforts on the ROC Water Quality Working Group that helped inform the initial watershed plans, which also informed the biennial progress report. Okay, I have some slides, and so can we go to slide 2, please? Excellent, thank you. So water has always been an issue in Southern California. We either get too much, too little, And so water has always been at the forefront of policymakers, engineers in Southern California. In November 2018, the LA County voters passed Measure W, which is the Safe Clean Water Program. And the program looks to improve water quality, increase water supply, and provide community benefits for the region. And thanks to the board's leadership, this measure was passed successfully. And as we start implementing Measure W, it's consistent with other key regional efforts, such as the Integrated Regional Water Management, the LA County Water Plan, and it looks to equitably improve water resiliency and sustainability through collaborative partnerships. And importantly, the Safe Clean Water Program helps to achieve county goals. One of the goals set by the LA County Board of Supervisors was to increase stormwater capture across the region by 300,000 acre feet by 2045, and the Safe Clean Water Program is one crucial aspect to help the region achieve that goal. Next slide, please. The Safe Clean Water Program, it's funded by a 2.5 cent special parcel tax, and it's per square foot of impermeable area across the jurisdiction of the program. This parcel tax generates approximately $280 million per year, and it goes towards three main funding buckets within the program. 50% of this fixed tax goes to infrastructure programs, and so this can help for physical infrastructure improvements, it can develop concepts, and it can also contribute to the state of the science by funding scientific studies. The other 40% is returned to the cities in proportion to the impervious areas within them. And so the cities get money from the program for their own activities as well. And then 10% of the program is used for administration. And importantly, within this administrative bucket of the Safe Clean Water Funds, it provides education, so public education, K through 12 education, workforce development. Some of those efforts are starting to get more underway right now, especially with respect to K through 12 and the workforce development. And the Safe Clean Water Program, we get that $280 million per year. And again, it's a fixed rate, so it doesn't increase with inflation. It doesn't increase with housing values. It's a standard 2.5 cents per square foot of impervious area. Next slide, please. So with this kind of funding, what type of investments are we getting with this? So where we are today, the Safe Clean Water Program has been able to invest in 885 new projects, studies, concepts, and or program activities across 86 municipalities to date. It's expended about $445 million into these different activities. And an important number I'll mention later too is 46 projects have been constructed to date. And of these 46 projects, 18 are regional program projects. The other 28 have been done by municipalities through the municipal program. Next slide. And with these kind of investments, we can anticipate these kinds of benefits over the next 5 years of the program. So, and since the program started, we now have better ways and tools to improve and track these benefits. One of the major new efforts has been initial watershed plans that have new metrics and abilities for watershed applicants, project proponents, municipalities, to site their projects in high opportunity areas and also to track the benefits. So what we can look forward to over these next 5 years is approximately 15,000 pounds of zinc removed per year, 25,000 pounds of total phosphorus being removed through the program. And then also on the water supply side, we have nearly 43,000 acre feet of stormwater that's being captured, stored, and reused. And there's also a complementary component of 20,000 acre feet of stormwater that's going to recharge the groundwater aquifer basins. And we know the groundwater basins are super important. They don't evaporate like reservoirs, so the more water that we can capture and put into the groundwater, the better. And then the other third key component of the Safe Clean Water Program investments are the community investment benefits. And so we're looking to have about 4,500 new trees installed, along with 64 acres of new park or green space come online as well. And then another component is the workforce development, which we're looking to have nearly 2,500 full-time job equivalents be developed through the program to date. And so these benefits are helping us move the program forward, move the region forward with water resiliency and water sustainability. Next slide, please. And of course, we're looking to always improve the effectiveness of the Safe Clean Water Program. One of the key aspects I alluded to earlier was watershed planning. It's looking to support strategic investments across the 9 watershed areas. And importantly, the watershed plans, these were one of the key items coming out of the 2024 Biannual Progress Report. So these were developed over the last 1.5 years through engagement with the different watershed area steering committees, community members, and others to develop high opportunity areas where investments make the dollar go the furthest. And what the watershed plans also do for each of the 9 watershed areas, they help provide targets for each of the different watersheds. They provide strategies, actions catered to each one. And along with how they provide targets, there's an online planning tool and dashboard that shows different project proponents where's the best place to put projects if you start considering water quality, water supply, or water quality disadvantaged communities. Because equity is a big part of the program, we want to make sure that we're uplifting the communities and helping those who are applying to receive the funding know where to best put the projects. Next slide, please. And so all that information sets the stage for the biannual progress report. The report, it reflects on the past and plans for the future. The biannual progress report is a part of the Safe Clean Water Program ordinance. It reviews the different regional, municipal, district program reports that are developed over the course of the years. And then it makes findings on how is the program working, what can it do to improve, and how do we move the needle on these regional issues of water supply, water quality, and uplifting communities. So it supports this continuous cycle of improvement and growth. Next slide, please. Biennial Progress Report, it utilizes the best available data through the Safe Clean Water Program. So with respect to project proponents and the data that we receive and request for as part of being applicant into the program, we were able to review the past 4 fiscal years worth of reported data. And then we're also able to just assess the adaptive management to date, any efforts, tasks that have gone on since the inception of the program, we're able to evaluate as well. And then finally, we also take a look at the findings and recommendations from the prior biennial report to see what has moved and what else do we want to look forward to. Next slide, please. And beyond just offering recommendations, the biennial progress report is a massive reference. Here, this shows a table of contents for the report, and I know findings and recommendations are the highly visible elements of the report and are really the important pieces that help move the needle, help drive progress on the Safe Clean Water Program. But then it's also a good reference. So all the appendices are data rich based on publicly available information on some of the dashboards and portals for the Safe Clean Water Program. Goes under the hood a little bit and provides even more information as well. So I encourage those who are interested to dive into the appendices as well. But the findings and recommendations are what move the program forward. Next slide, please. So we know Safe Clean Water Program, it helps to support regional water quality. The program is expected to collect about $3.4 billion by 2038. And that number's a cumulative present value of the regional and municipal program funds to date. And of course, some of those funds, they're used for scientific studies. They're also used to develop concepts. Those funds are eligible for infrastructure program projects that come in at the conceptual level so we can design them to 100% and then also construct them. So the funds are used for a variety of portions for the infrastructure program. And then as a region, as Public Works, and as other municipalities and other applicants participate in the program, the projects, what we have been seeing, the projects have escalated in cost. And, of course, there's a long runway to get these projects up and running. And a lot of that is for valid reasons, especially with the careful planning and siting of these projects, the authentic community engagement that's needed to make sure that the community voices are heard, that they're uplifted as these projects enter into their communities, ensuring sustainable designs that are climate resilient and hardened and for enduring the future storms that we've been seeing as well. And then construction. It takes many years to get these projects through a lot of collaboration across the finish line. Okay, next slide, please. And so through the first 5 years of the program, as these projects are coming online, the very first year of the program, we saw 41 projects funded with about $380 million from the Safe Clean Water Program and another $340 million from leveraged sources, so totaling nearly $720 million worth of investments. And there's a slow, steady increase in the projects that are being funded. And so now in year five, 137 projects have been funded with about $995 million worth of Safe Clean Water funding, along with leverage funding of over $620 million. And so these funding partnerships are crucial to make sure that we're making the investments and making sure that they're cost effective as we're moving forward. And then importantly, as these projects are going through these cycles of design and construction, we are starting to see some of these project benefits start accruing and coming online. So next slide, please. The 46 projects that have been constructed to date using Safe Clean Water Program funds, again, about 18 of those were regional projects, 28 were from city municipal projects. So what they're servicing right now is about 38,000 acres of watershed area. And as they receive water, stormwater from the different watershed areas, of course, there's going to be the water quality benefits. And there's the water supply benefits. And these projects often are really new green infrastructure projects that are a community amenity for those who live and work and play nearby these projects. So what we're anticipating as these projects start converting from conceptual to design into construction, we're looking to get more and more ramp up with the different projects across the program. And importantly, the initial watershed plans that are informing this biennial progress report, they're able to offer the metrics in a planning dashboard where we can more readily track all the benefits that are expected to come online. Next slide, please. And so I've walked us through some of the funding of the program, the investments to date, the projects that are being constructed. And so another key piece that informed the biennial progress report, also want to highlight the projects that have been constructed, the community amenities that they are. So we have the first one is the Urban Orchard Park. And if any of you are familiar with this, it's in the city of Southgate. It was constructed by them. It's wedged between the LA River and the 710 freeway. It was a vacant lot before, so it created a new park space in an underserved community. And this project received about $5 million worth of regional program funds. The capital cost was about $27 million for this project. And what this project is now accomplishing is it's capturing, on average, about 100 acre feet per year of stormwater. It's removing zinc and phosphorus. And this project, I especially like many years ago when I was not with the Safe Clean Water Program, but still with LA County Public Works, I was on the side of a watershed manager helping the city of Southgate with this project. And so I believe even as early as 2015, we were writing letters of support for this project. And then in 2018-19, we were helping with the concept and working on agreements to get this project in place. And I had been out to the site a few times, and it is isolated by the freeway and then the river. And it's a phenomenal community asset for the people who work and play out there. So it would be one of those sites where I encourage those take a tour of it and see one of these successes. Next slide, please. Another project is Adventure Park by LA County Public Works. This was a project that utilized both the regional program funds and municipal funds. So together it got about $17 million to construct a stormwater capture feature with detention basins or infiltration chambers below ground. And this project is capturing nearly 200 acre feet per year of stormwater, and it's removing zinc and phosphorus as well. And again, another community amenity. Next slide, please. And the final project that I'll close on, I was going through a fully funded regional project, a project that used, and then the project prior was regional and municipal. This project is solely a municipal funded project. This is Hamilton Park out in the city of Pomona. And it renovated a much-needed community park located in a disadvantaged community. And again, this project, it's capturing stormwater and managing a watershed area of 247 acres. And again, with all these projects, you see the people working and playing at all these sites. And they do the heavy lifting of helping the region move to capture more stormwater and improve water quality and provide these community benefits. Other projects before I was involved with Safe Clean Water Program, I know one project that was funded was actually at my daughter's school in Pasadena. It's a watershed discovery campus. And seeing some of those nature-based solutions before I knew it was even a Safe Clean Water project was really neat and fascinating, seeing the kids climbing on the trees, the stumps, seeing the permeable paver on some of the campuses. And so that's also another important aspect of the program, is to get into the school space as well. All right, next slide. So all those prior slides were references all that data, all those adaptive management efforts, all those projects, those were all pieces that fed into and informed the biennial progress report. The biennial report, it's a work product of the regional oversight committee members. There's a smaller work group that sits down, and we met nearly monthly, a couple times a month, to help draft the report for the regional, for the ROC members themselves. And this is their report to determine how the program is functioning and how it should set a vision for the next 2 years, and essentially even longer than that. So there were 12 recommendations within the report. Of the ones that are most pertinent for water quality and MS4 are highlighted right here. So the first one is integrate the watershed plans to guide strategic investments. So these plans were being developed concurrently as the biennial progress report was being drafted as well. And so there was a lot of circular iterations going on as these two were being prepared. But we know that the initial watershed plans, they were highly informed by a water quality working group that Assistant Executive Officer Newman was on, along with Board Member Camacho, were helping support that the memo that helped inform how to describe the region's targets and even the Safe Clean Water Program's contributions to goal setting. And so this is going to be helpful to have project proponents to know where are the most effective areas to implement these projects moving forward. It helps us to track better. A third item was develop post-construction monitoring and integrate with regional monitoring. Safe Clean Water Program requires A lot of monitoring and reporting for program applicants. A lot of this is for accountability purposes, for the public funds of being good stewards, making sure that the benefits that are being claimed are reported. And a lot of them are also MS4 permit use as well. And so we recognize, and the ROC members recognize, that there's an opportunity to partner and help find ways to improve the reporting among both of those major efforts. The next item that's helpful for water quality is supporting municipal staffing challenges. This can be an acute issue at times, and a lot of the Safe Clean Water Program staff on my team, they'll be working with cities, and then there'll be a new person or a different person and no person at times. And so what could be helpful is recognized by different applicants and even the ROC members, is that Public Works, being a leader in stormwater capture across the region and also being involved with the program so closely, is considering the ability to expand and support different municipalities through the regional program or the municipal program as well. And then finally, the final recommendation is to create a scientific advisory panel. Safe Clean Water Program, there is that one bucket that provides scientific studies funding. And what we've heard over the last year or so, and the ROC members are recommending, is that we need a more strategic vision to advance the state of the science. And so this is currently already in development. And so we're looking to stand up a scientific advisory panel to guide the future and help us achieve and contribute to water quality compliance. All right. And then another component that wasn't listed on this slide too that is also important to you is nature-based solutions. So that's another recommendation within the report. And that's actually coming out of the LA County Water Plan as well. There was a blue ribbon panel established for nature-based solutions. And the LA County Water Plan was leading the efforts with this MBS blue ribbon panel. Recommendations have come out to define standards and definitions. And now there's a continuing phase of how do we, now that we know how to define MBS within our region, how do we measure performance with the metrics? How do we compare one MBS to another? And we know the state is doing making significant strides with this as well. And so we're looking to continue to push MBS and improve the resiliency of the region. Okay, next slide. Biennial progress report, we are close to the finish line with this. The ROC members started drafting and hearing some initial input last February. We heard from the different Safe Clean Water Program Governance Committee members. We heard from watershed coordinators, who are some of the outreach folks within the Safe Clean Water Program to engage with communities and help get projects into the application cycle. We also heard from the public and other community members on development of this, of the Biennial Progress Report. A lot of work has gone into this. And so at the next Regional Oversight Committee meeting in March, ROC members are anticipated to take action on the Biennial Progress Report, and if approved, it gets submitted to the LA County Board of Supervisors for their use, and it significantly impacts the program and sets the direction, like I said, for the next 2 years and invariably into the future as well. So with that, we are moving into a period of adaptive management and implementing the Safe Clean Water Program and those recommendations. And we're thankful for the regional board's leadership, guidance, insights, and especially thankful for regional board member Camacho's input into drafting this biennial progress report. So thank you.
Thank you very much. We have, I think, a couple of remote virtual speakers, so I want to hear from them first, and then I'm sure we'll have a number of questions for you. We can come back and do that. Okay, great. Thank you. So The first speaker I have is again Ms. Magana. I don't know if this time we'll be able to hear her.
She's still not online.
Still not online. Okay. Then I think we can turn to Ms. Annalisa Moe from Gilda Bay.
Hello. Are you all able to hear me?
Yes, we can hear you.
Excellent. There's a little bit of an echo for the folks online, so I'm just going to turn the volume down on my side, but that should not affect you all. Well, good morning. For the record, my name is Annalisa with Heal the Bay. We serve as a core team member of the Our Water LA Coalition, and I'd like to share some of the comments that the coalition submitted on the biennial report. First, given the relevance to your work, I want to talk about post-construction monitoring and regional alignment. Safe Clean Water Program projects are being funded and built at scale, but we still lack consistent post-construction performance evaluation. We appreciate the recommendation to develop monitoring guidance and, you know, to align with the regional board monitoring efforts. This alignment should go beyond data sharing and should really ensure that Safe Clean Water Program investments demonstrably contribute to MS4 compliance and TMDL progress and, you know, measurable receiving water improvements. So the regional board's technical leadership here, especially with your role on the regional oversight committee, is indispensable. Long-term financial stability also needs to be addressed. So preliminary forecasting shows we're going to need more projects than can be constructed and maintained with available Safe Clean Water Program dollars. We support financial forecasting. We just want to make sure that those tools are transparent and grounded in really clear assumptions. As stewards of water quality compliance across the region, you understand that underfunded operations and maintenance can really undermine water quality outcomes. So the long-term maintenance of green infrastructure programs must be secured upfront. Now, I know that the LA Regional Board worked with an expert to analyze the economics of the MS4 program, and I think it would be really helpful for the board to engage here to help the program understand how funds were allocated and forecasted prior to the Safe Clean Water Program to improve understanding and to ensure that these funds are supplementing our initial investments rather than replacing them. I also need to highlight equity, community engagement, and nature-based solutions, because these need to be treated as core pillars to the program and not secondary conditions. Community voices are largely absent in the biennial report, and smaller cities, schools, and CBOs face barriers, while nature-based solutions lack scoring incentives. So we recommend minimum engagement requirements, set-asides for small or first-time applicants, and streamlined city letter processes. Each year, Our Water LA selects the very best projects to uplift and support for funding. These are projects that offer like the maximum benefits for water quality, water supply, and community investments, as well as nature-based solutions. Most years we see like 5 to 10 projects fall in this category. And again, this year we have 5 exemplary projects. We would love to see more projects each year fall in this category, and often community engagement and nature-based solutions are where they fall short. And a couple seconds more, I just want to be clear that Our Water LA considers all of the projects submitted this year as good projects. Our list of exemplary projects really just highlights the very best to show the potential for this program. Thank you very much. Sorry for the extra time.
Thank you, Ms. Mo. Thanks very much for your comments. All right, let's move on to questions from board members for Mr. Alexander Sinner. So who would like to go first?
Hi, yes, thank you so much for your very comprehensive presentation. Given the focus of nature-based solutions and habitat restoration, I'm wondering if you can tell me about how the LA River, particularly the soft bottom sections and the sections that go by Taylor Yard, if there are projects that are being incorporated into this program. I know that the river has long been sort of embattled, and I've lost track of where exactly it is, but curious if this is an opportunity to maybe actually do some meaningful riparian habitat restoration.
That's a great question. And I, off the top of my head, I'm not sure if there's any projects in that location along the river. But the Safe Clean Water Program, to apply for those regional program funds, there must be water supply benefits, water quality benefits, and community investment benefits. And so there's a scoring threshold that projects need to cross, which once they cross, then the watershed area steering committees can then receive and hear them and consider them for funding. So projects could potentially be located in any of those locations. Just it needs to meet a certain criteria, and then it's up to the committees to decide if it's worth pursuing.
Understood. Thank you. That's it.
Yeah, to build off of that comment as well, I know that the initial watershed plans are out now, and it would be interesting in regards to the LA River. I'm just wondering how the integrate the initial watershed plans have used the information from the LA River Environmental Flows Project to help inform opportunities in that general watershed area.
So again, I'm apologize, Member Camacho. Not sure if that data source was included. I know the initial watershed plans did a very comprehensive scouring of all existing data sources. So whether it was the LA Basin Study or the City Stormwater Capture Master Plan, there and other the WIMPs and eWIMPs, there's a lot of information that was pulled into it. And it'd be interesting to take a look at, which anyone could take a look at on the initial watershed planning tools online and see where some of the, I guess, the heat maps, the hot spots are for different areas of interest. So on the planning tool, you can take a look at, and it does overlay water supply, water quality benefits, or water supply, water quality, and disadvantaged communities. And you can start zooming into your own communities, different areas, to see what type of projects are best designed for those areas for the highest opportunities. So encourage the board, and we can send out links to those as well.
Yeah, and having traversed the links and looking at the maps, I think that all of us should take some time to play around with that to see what opportunities pop up and are available, because it's very I think it's a very good planning tool to be utilized and to help direct the WASCs to those opportunities which are most advantageous in terms of meeting the multi-benefit goals of the program. And one other thing I wanted to bring up as well is how important, again, the post-construction monitoring and that integration with the regional program. I know that there's been a lot of feedback just sitting on the Regional Oversight Committee on how jurisdictions, especially the smaller ones, feel very overwhelmed by the amount of monitoring reporting that they not only do for the Safe Clean Water Program, but for all the other reports that they are providing as well, too. So I think that partnering with us and with the program is going to be really key in terms of using the data that's available, being efficient in the data use, and spending that save time in analysis of how the program is actually operating. And if not operating as intended, to go back to the initial watershed plans and to make some adaptive changes within that to prioritize other types of projects. And so the hope is that it would be an iterative process in which the post-construction monitoring data will help inform new directions in the initial watershed plans.
Yeah, and I won't say adaptive management's in our blood, it's in our water. So that's always going to be part of the program. Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you so much for the briefing on this. I look forward to downloading the full report and seeing it adopted by the Board of Supervisors. Two questions. The first is regarding school-based projects and nature-based based projects or multi-benefit projects. You mentioned a couple cases there. Is there any movement to further expand these collaborative projects on school sites. I know later we're going to be having in the coming months a briefing from a report from Tree People looking at opportunities on school sites for stormwater management. And Annalisa Moll mentioned about the smaller schools as well having difficulties, particularly being first-time applicants. So maybe if you could elaborate a little bit more on collaborations with schools and particularly those that are in smaller in scale.
Yeah, so schools, right, have always been challenging, and it's also a place where you can certainly have some of the greatest impacts with the students and the greening and the cooling. And some of the projects, some of the early safe clean water projects have been implemented, have been up in the Foothill area. So the city of Monrovia has a project or two. City of Pasadena has a couple projects at their schools. And those are largely driven by some local NGOs, CBOs, who see opportunities to improve the greening and essentially remove a lot of the impervious area mm-hmm. at the schools too. And so it's through those NGO partnerships that a lot of the schools are getting these projects. And especially with MBS, we have the new standards and definitions. We're working on the metrics for MBS, as I mentioned. But another component too kind of shifts back to the Safe Clean Water Program and the district program with its education aspects. Mm-hmm. And we're just launching a new initiative for K through 12 education, crafting a vision document. There was a lot of previous legwork done to understand the landscape of curriculum at schools. And so this new effort is developing a vision for how do we get into schools, how is this curriculum developed. And then another component of that is some design guidelines as well, because not every NGO or CBO might have the ability or skill set to approach a school with its own set of designs. And so we also consider these design guidelines an aspect of education, whether it's the NGO or CBO that's trying to use them, or even some other smaller firms who are new into this area. So that's mm-hmm. another tool that's going to be in progress to help set up some standard templates, standard guidelines of how students could interact with stormwater features at their campus.
Well, that's exciting to hear that there's some level of guidance, and I'm guessing you're hoping, I hope that you're expanding on technical assistance, particularly for those schools that don't have an NGO in the area to partner with to see how we could get some of these projects there, and particularly in those in disadvantaged neighborhoods of those schools.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's a great point. Thanks for saying that, Board Member Mendez. So within the regional program aspect, we have what's called the Technical Resources Program. Mm-hmm. And that used to provide $300,000 to an applicant to help them develop a concept to meet the feasibility guidelines to apply for greater funds. And we recently bumped that up to $400,000 per year to help consider engagement efforts within the community and boost that technical assistance.
Okay. Well, that's exciting. So I just to hope that that's fleshed out more. And as LA Waterkeeper, or was it Annalisa Mo mentioned, about making sure that these equity metrics, multi-benefit nature-based projects have become strong pillars of the program going forward. And then the last comment is really excited that you're proposing to do a scientific advisory board to look for research gaps. I think that's quite important to bring various different experts to find out, what is needed going forward. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Welcome. Thank you.
All right. Well, let me also add my thanks, Mr. Alexanderson, for your presentation here today, and my thanks to Board Member Camacho for all of her work on the ROC. And I think as chair, I have a role to play there, and I plan to partner more with you as we go forward. So I've got a couple of questions to ask you. First, I've read with great interest all of the recommendations here. I'm particularly interested in number 9. For me, that would probably get elevated to number 1, because I think that transparency in the municipal program is just absolutely essential. I think according to your materials, there's like $446 million that are committed to the cities under the city program. And yet I think many people believe that accountability in terms of how that money is being spent, what projects it's being spent on, that aspect of the program needs to be improved upon. So I think you know, the wording is to improve transparency in municipal program expenditures and activities. Can you tell us how that's going to work? It's a tier one item, so.
Yeah, and so for reference for other board members, tier one are items that can be undertaken by LA County flood control staff that doesn't require approval from director or higher level efforts. So with the municipal program reporting, there's a variety of items we're looking to request, because at one point the program was on a quarterly reporting basis, which was burdensome for the applicants. And that was one of the items where we hear from them that all this reporting is a challenge. And so we moved it to semi-annual reporting. But with respect to the transparency of the municipal program, like, we want to clarify the activities that are funded through that, because they can provide what they're working on, and then sometimes the application or the reporting module itself, it's not always as stringent as it could be or as clarifying as some of the fields could allow for. So we're trying to make sure that when the cities report, that they must report what's ever being requested in the field or provide that support to make sure that it's clear for them.
And you're confident that these efforts will bear fruit, and that therefore the reporting that comes back from the cities will have, you know, greater clarity, and that can be, I mean, you know, this is LA County taxpayers' money. It's not particular, you know, the program belongs to the people of LA County as a whole. And so I think it's incumbent on all of us to make sure that everybody in LA County knows exactly how their taxpayer money is being spent, on what projects and what the results are. So I'll leave it at that. We can
I support that as well. Stewardship is important with this money. We are trusted with the taxpayer money, and we're eager to help increase the transparency. Also, another component are the audits. The municipal program goes through annual audits. The regional program has audits as well, mm-hmm. And so it's on top of the reporting that comes through the program, there's the audit requirements as well. And as we continue to implement the program, there's adaptive management. And I know we say that often, but as we increase the transparency with this reporting cycle, with the municipal program, we'll view, observe, and then adapt the path as needed.
Yeah. Yeah, I think the results of those audits and the reporting and that, you know, I think it's very, very important that be publicized to the public, so that, you know, and by the way, I've advocated the same thing for Measure A, you know, mm-hmm. the homelessness measure that many of us have supported. So now as that money comes in, it becomes, there's a whole PR aspect of this, which is to report back to the people who voted for it and whose tax money is paying for it. So thank you for that. So I had a question about how you report out, you know, the projects that are done and then how those projects are actually performed. So I'm just looking at, for instance, the Adventure Park thing. So what you've reported here is that it's cost about $16.5 million, and that there is 190 acre feet of annual stormwater capture. So I think that, not for now, but as you do this, you know, in the future, you know, that $16 million is is, you know, capital money that is spent for the project, kind of one time, whereas the 190 acre feet is annual, and right. It'll go on forever, mm-hmm. right? So I think you know, somebody who isn't familiar with this may look at that and say, wait a minute, $16.5 million for 190 acre feet. So I think it would be helpful to explain to folks, as you put this out there, that no, this is this money that is spent one time. Yes, we have ongoing O&M, but it pales in comparison to what the initial capital cost is. But this is a gift that will keep on giving for many, many years to come. So I think, and then the other thing that I would like us to be talking about a little bit more, it, you know, in addition to all of what my fellow board members have said, are the jobs that are created, you know, you've talked about the beautification, but all of the people that are put to work, mm-hmm. with productive work, good paying jobs, union jobs, when we follow this, which I think is also an aspect of this that I would like to see a lot better explained, I'll put it that way, to people. So let me ask you, and as you may know, I served on a WASC, on the Upper LA River WASC, and many of the projects would be City of LA, County of LA, because you have the resources to actually do the applications. So we would approve the money, but in terms of who then would actually get to do that work, so could you explain to us how does that process actually work for you? So you go to the WASC, you get the commit for the money, then what do you do? Do you put an RFP out for the private sector to come and actually perform the work, or how does that process work? Because I don't think it's not LA County personnel, just like it's not LA City personnel that are actually doing the work itself.
Sure. So for those large regional program projects, mm-hmm. Whether it's the city or the county or whoever's applying for them, once they get approval through the Stormwater Investment Plan, through the WASC, then it goes to LA County Board of Supervisors to get final approval of the allocated budget based on the recommended SIP. And then there's a step where whoever is receiving the awarded money enters into an agreement to transfer the funds. And so each of the applicants who are awarded money, they follow their own process to go out to bid. So whether it's putting an RFP out there, so it's individual to each one.
I was asking about your process.
Right. And so Public Works.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so when we receive the money, and oftentimes the money sometimes accrues over the years to get enough in the to go out to bid, and so the team will put those RFPs out or request for statement of qualifications depending on the project, because some of these newer green infrastructure projects are a little more challenging than others with the way we need to move stormwater around and infiltrate, and they'll go out to bid from there.
All right. Okay, yeah, thank you. Thank you very much. Again, I think, you know, the whole jobs aspect of this, the fact that the private sector is also brought into this equation is again, important to explain to folks. So thank you very, very much. Are there any other questions or comments? No.
Just one comment.
Go ahead.
Yeah, in terms of your comment in regards to the municipal program, and that was very, very much a concern of the Regional Oversight Committee members as well. And they have actually put down deadlines in here in terms of their expectation as to when more transparency is going to be occurring and ready. So it is a high priority.
Okay. Great. Good. Thank you. Thanks for that. All right. Thank you very, very much. Thank you for coming. Thank you for your time. Thank you for an excellent presentation. So appreciated.
You're welcome. Have a great day.
Thank you. All right. We're going to move on now to item number 11, which is an informational briefing on NASA's Jet Propulsion Lab and its sensing capabilities and applications for local and regional environmental challenges. And the staff introduction will be led by our EO, Susanna Arredondo. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Chair. The board will now receive an informational presentation from NASA Jet Propulsion Laboratory, also known as JPL, a federally funded research and development center managed by Caltech for NASA. JLPA is a global leader in robotic space exploration, earth science, and advanced technology development. Today's presentation will provide an overview of their current initiatives and emerging opportunities relevant to our work. We look forward to their insight and the discussion that will follow. I will now ask Dr. Ralph Basilio up to the podium, who is a spaceflight project manager in the Earth Science Development and Operations at the NASA Jet Propulsion Laboratory. Following his presentation, it will be Dwayne Wallazer and Michelle Grigrich. Thank you.
Yeah. Good morning, Chair Nahai. Good morning, board members, Christensen, Camacho, Mendez. It's an honor and privilege to be here today. We really appreciate the invitation to provide you with this informative presentation, and we look forward to an engaging question and answer period. From my perspective, just to let you know, this is the first time I've been at the LA Regional Water Board meeting, and I've been listening intently, you know, during the course of the morning. And I've been listening intently and of interest for all of these things, because a lot of the topics that were discussed resonate with us at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. So Ms. Laurel Firestone talked about some interest and some studies that were done at the California State Water Board about snow water equivalent, the reservoir levels. And she also talked profoundly, I think, about the concerns that we have for the future, given climate change and what's going to happen. How do we provide water for 40 million residents in the state of California, our agricultural needs, and also the needs for the ecosystem? So it's a very delicate balance, and we are very sensitive to that. And we just heard from the LA County Public Works Department. So Mr. Lee Alexanderson talked about a biennial report on regional water quality. So all of these things really resonate with me and also with my colleagues. I also want to recognize Dr. Christine Lee. She's not able to be here today, but she's a panelist and is online to answer any questions you may have. So if I may have the next slide, maybe we can advance two slides, please. So I wanted to provide a little bit more of an overview about JPL, because I think some people may wonder, you know, JPL and, you know, what's the connection with water. So really quickly, JPL has its origin back in the mid-1930s. There was research work done with rockets and rocket technology, and that was in its infancy. So at that time, there was an institution called the Guggenheim Aeronautical Institution at Caltech. And that was led by Theodore von Karman, who was a leader, you know, an icon in the industry. And he worked with a lot of graduate students, and they did a lot of rocket research in a dry lake bed. And during the course of the 1930s, 1940s, there was a lot of research done for the, at that time, the U.S. Army Air Corps, which later became the U.S. Air Force. There was a lot of research in rockets. So how do we, you know, how are we now known as a Jet Propulsion Laboratory? Well, there was research that was done on what they call these JATO units, so Jet Assist Takeoff Rockets. And those rockets were used basically to, they were used to attach to propeller-driven aircraft at the time. And those JATO packs actually helped heavy aircraft get off the ground in a shorter distance. And so that name stuck. So that's been, you know, kind of our moniker over, you know, the last 90 years now. And as Susanna talked about us, we are a part of the global space community. And after all of those research with the rockets, we kind of turned our attention to working for NASA. And now we are known today as a leading NASA field center for the robotic exploration of the solar system, which obviously includes the Earth and beyond. Board Member Christensen talked about the remote sensing capabilities. Our remote sensing capabilities started out in the 1960s and continue today. So it's not just from space, but we have airborne instruments that provide remote sensing capabilities. Board Member Mendez, you talked a little bit about artificial intelligence. There's a big thrust today at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory to take full advantage of these technologies, data science, machine learning, and AI. So it's not just about remote sensing, but it's also about modeling as well, computer modeling. And we try to fuse all of that together, not just for the benefit of science and research, but you'll hear later from my colleagues that today, over the last, say, 10 or 15 years, it's become more apparent to us that we have to provide more value, more utility to the community. And I think the community today is not just expecting it, they're demanding it. So you'll hear throughout the course of this presentation, the Q&A, that data applications is a key part of who we are today. And with JPL being in Pasadena and being in your backyard, we feel that we are we should be looked at as important members of the community. We have a lot to contribute. We have a lot to offer. So let's quickly go to the next few slides. Next slide, please. So JPL is an FFRDC. It's a federally funded research and development center. There's, I think, approximately 42 throughout the nation. There's 8 here in the state of California. So Lawrence, Livermore, Lawrence, Berkeley, and maybe closer to home, you've heard of the Aerospace Corporation, the RAND Corporation. These are government-owned, contractor-operated facilities. And you heard my reference to Caltech earlier. We'll go to the next slide soon. But I just wanted to leave you with this message here that FFRDCs exist to assist the government and also to act in the public's best interest, serve the interests of society, basically. Next chart. So JPL is a nonprofit organization. JPL is actually a operating division of Caltech. So unlike the other nine NASA field centers, those of us that work at JPL are not civil servants. We actually are Caltech employees. And because of that, we're nonprofit. We're driven, again, by doing good things for society. Next slide. And one of the things is that we pride ourselves and value partnership. So we're looking at this, I would say, initial interaction with the LA Regional Water Board as just the first in a series of conversations and discussions where we can contribute to everything that is meaningful for us as a community. And this is just kind of this was a press release about a year ago talking about the state of California State of California looking more and more to engage the services of NASA Jet Propulsion Laboratory. So about 13 months ago, we had those fires, Eaton Canyon, and also with the Palisades. You're going to hear a lot more about what we can do with water quality-related topics. But in this particular case with the state, it's not just water quality, but there's also air quality topics of interest. And I'm going to be handing the floor over to my colleague, Dr. Dwayne Walliser. And again, he's going to elaborate more on the work that we're doing with data applications to serve the best interest of society and the public.
Thanks, Ralph. It's a pleasure to be here, Chairman Nahai and Board. This is really exciting to me. I love California, and I love L.A. I really do. I think it's especially this time of year, right, to live here. And one thing that I'm really, really excited about and enthusiastic is the maturity of NASA's and JPL's contributions to its maturity in terms of technology and observations. Sure. Okay, thank you. Watching over the last couple of decades, NASA and JPL helping NASA mature the observing technologies, the modeling, and the expertise to the point where we can have a conversation like this that I think is really meaningful and an interaction is really fun for me and I think my colleagues. And NASA's denoted this from a strategic point of view as of 2024 with the strategy they call Earth Science to Action that really denotes the idea that really our science and expertise has matured to the point where we can start providing value and benefit. And not just on a global perspective, which we can, we actually tackle problems like global sea level, global carbon dioxide loading in the atmosphere, but we also are getting to the point where we can service really more local decision support items like I'm going to try and highlight now for you. And that's captured in that report that we gave you copies of. So I'll just have about four slides to highlight this notion that I'm talking about. So next slide, please. And this slide is meant to convey a couple different things. One, the middle figure highlights what Ralph talked about. We put satellites in space to observe the Earth in all of many different contexts. And if you go to the next, hit that one more time. This just showcases that NASA and JPL look at all different aspects of the Earth system, from the ice sheets at the poles to the greenhouse gases in the atmosphere to the hazards on land, fires and earthquakes and so forth, freshwater, global ocean and variability and so forth, and sea level rise. And if you're an earth scientist, my colleagues and I, it's really fun work. Really feel humbled to do the kind of work that we get to do on behalf of NASA. Another thing that this slide is meant to highlight that not only do we do global science from space, that is getting to the point where we are looking at scales that you see there relative to society. And the next slide is meant to highlight that in even more detail, along with the report you have. So if you could move on one more slide. This just gives you an illustration that in the next slide, that our capabilities are getting down to these decision support scales that you all are concerned about. On the left here is some different observations of trace gases, atmospheric constituents. On the upper left, there's carbon dioxide, carbon methane, NO2. There's also a landfill there that you guys are probably familiar with, Chiquita Landfill. That's a real challenge, right? And there's some methane plumes that are captured there by an airborne instrument coming off of the Chiquita Landfill. The lower one is actually a demonstration of some success of the sort of things that folks like you work on, in this case, air quality. So the image on the left is diesel particulates observed from space, like in the 2010 time frame. And then because of regulations and the good work of, you know, sort of folks like you, the evidence that our air quality has improved over time in the basin of L.A. One more time. This is some additional observations from a mixture of aircraft and satellite that just highlight, for example, extreme heat there on the top. That's actually the JPL laboratory on a very warm day, and those areas in orange are, you know, the pavement's probably at least 100 degrees, if not more, and the streets you can see, and there's a couple streets in there that have been painted with reflective paint to make them cooler. That's, anyway, what the point of that diagram is. But we're seeing scales like that. The middle one is actually similar scales of observation for evapotranspiration, and the bottom one is actually our ability, which is to me just amazing, to characterize or quantify the amount of carbon captured by the landscape. So the units of that is actually so carbon per meter squared per second. And you can see the LA indication there in San Fernando Valley and a bit of where we are today. And one more, moving next one slide further. We also have the ability to watch land move. On the upper part, you can kind of recognize Palos Verdes and that slow motion that's been sliding for the last couple of years. We have great technology that monitors that kind of thing. And in the bottom plot, similarly, watching the ground move up and down in association with all kinds of different pumping and other items related to whether it's oil and gas or water. So that's just to try and highlight that, you know, this is why we're excited to be here, because we're starting to develop technologies and capabilities that really inform us for the kind of decisions that you make. So moving to the next slide, to actually fresh water, more to your interest level. So another thing we take a lot of pride in is that we've managed to help NASA learn to measure all kinds of quantities across the water landscape or water cycle. This is a diagram our colleague J.T. Rieger, who's online, put together just to highlight the various elements of the water cycle that we actually can measure from air and space. Now, there's a lot of there's a variation in fidelity in how well we measure these. In some cases, there's quantities that we get a good measurement once a month at fairly coarse scales. There's other measurements on here where we might get two measurements in 2 weeks or two measurements in 10 days, and there's some that we actually can see every day. And so all of those have concerns, and we brought this up, and JT made the point that, you know, while we know the you're really interested in water quality issues and items, which is what my colleague Michelle will expand on here in a second, that variability and extremes in just water availability have so much to do with water quality in so many instances. And so in all those cases that you see there, we have some technology to highlight and observe those quantities, and in some cases model, like Ralph said, to fill in places where we don't have observations. So next slide. And this is just to highlight that, and you guys talked about groundwater today. This is what, actually, can you go back one slide? I'm sorry. I wanted to just highlight that this measurement that you see here comes from that measurement system you see in the upper right, that those two satellites together there, that's called GRACE. We have a sequence of them. We have GRACE for about 10 years, and then we've had GRACE follow-on that followed that, and we have a long time series now. But how exquisite some of the stuff is from JPL and NASA and the engineers at JPL, and is those two satellites are pretty much identical. They're about the size of one of these blue tables in the room, and they're 200 kilometers apart. So say like the distance between here and San Diego. And we track the distance between them to within a fraction of a human hair. And they're oscillating back and forth with that level of sensitivity we can detect actually helps us monitor the amount of mass changes on the surface of the Earth, on sort of the upper period, which helps us monitor the total amount of water that you see in this figure here with great precision. It's just that it's all combined together in totality. So we attempt to take that total measurement and sort of back off the surface water, back off the snowpack as best we can, and that leaves the amount of groundwater and the variations in groundwater, for example. And so if you go to the next slide, this is this long time series from this measurement called GRACE. In that region highlighted by that yellow outline, that's sort of the total amount of water that's in California in that region to a fair bit of detail. And you can see it changing over time and sort of declining too because of some of the losses over time related to surface water, but especially groundwater. And this measurement somebody mentioned, I think, David, you mentioned earlier, the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act. That's an indication on the right there that this measurement, as of about a year ago, JT has helped manage to get that this measurement to have some decision value within the context of the SGMA, and it's now updated in this semiannual report. So with that, that's pretty much what I wanted to accomplish, is just sort of convey an excitement that we're getting to the point where we can have some value for the kinds of discussions we're having here across the landscape for water in general, in particular, and then I'm going to hand it over to my colleagues again.
If I can have the next slide, please. Next one. Yeah, thank you very much. So in discussions we had over the last several weeks, this is just a listing of the topics that we feel that you as a board are interested in. So we wanted to communicate or convey to you that we are listening. And this is just kind of a top-level set of topics, you know, that we've come up with. So we've heard topics even today about stormwater collection. We've talked a little bit about water quality. And we've also in recent weeks heard that, if I'm not mistaken, you as a regional water board are actually developing a plan for permits for marine carbon dioxide removal. So we've been engaged also with other individuals that are interested in looking at water quality and improving life for us as a community, not just within LA, Southern California, but all of California. So Ms. Leslie Tamanin from the Seventh Generation Advisors, she actually communicated to us that this was a topic of the board. And if you can click one more time, I just wanted to highlight that Dr. Michelle Garrick is going to be talking to you about a few of these topics here. The one thing we wanted to communicate to you also is that we pride ourselves in being an honest broker and a trusted partner. There are areas where we can contribute, help fill gaps in decision-making, but there are other areas where we don't have the technology today, but maybe in the future we will. So I'd like to ask Dr. Michelle Garrick to please take it away for the next set of slides.
So as Ralph mentioned, these are just a few examples, but even from this meeting, I heard so many others that I feel we have assets that can help with, whether it's identification of aquatic and terrestrial invasive species, as we heard for the Bayonne Creek Land Trust, or even with respect to the California State Water Research Board, when they were talking about sort of water supply and monitoring where, in fact, it's coming from for residents here in LA. We've had some projects actually assessing water quality conditions in the Bay Delta. So where you have turbidity, generally the endangered California Delta smelt like to hang out. So that helps inform by having these turbidity plume maps when in fact the facility operations need to shut down the intake valves, because obviously it's very time consuming as well as costly for them to have to remediate that. So overall, there's several things that I heard, and the first being highlighting the point that Chairperson Christensen brought up, the importance of co-design and co-development with stakeholders. In the past, we have largely had great products. We sort of come out and we show you things, but we're really making a concerted effort towards having those conversations, working with individuals such as yourself to develop the products that you want and need for decision-making purposes. So some of those examples you're going to see actually are, in fact, that. The other one that Dwayne had brought up, which other individuals in the State Water Research Board had brought up as well, this idea, even though we're talking about mainly coastal and inland water quality, it's really a full sort of land to sea or catchment to coast issue, as the Delta smelt issue sort of brought up, right? If we look at that, then it also affects our water quality or water supply that comes down. So those are just a couple of things that I hope you guys hear. So in the examples I'm going to provide, think about that. It's really co-design, co-development, but also some of the examples are really from sort of more of the monitoring and how this information can be used for compliance reporting, whether it's, you know, the 613B looking at thermal discharge and so on and so forth. So if we go to the next slide, this one is on wastewater. So we have been working with the City of LA, with the Environmental Monitoring Division back in 2015, but also in 2006 when the Hyperion Treatment Plant had their wastewater diversion events where they brought that 5-mile pipe, that Y that you see, down to the 1 mile. When they obviously go to the 1 mile, given it's closer to the coast, closer to people, they have an extensive monitoring program that they have to do. They contacted Ben Holt, I don't know if he's online, and myself to sort of provide a different component. Clearly, they will always, and we will always need field sampling, but remote sensing can sort of fill in the gaps and provide a different level view of things. So we worked with them to assess the quality of the water as this was going on and inform them if, in fact, there were some additional instances or issues that popped up. So to give you an idea on that top, again, this is for the 2015 diversion that's showing you surface temperature. So in the 1 mile pipe, as it's emitting the effluent, it's basically bringing up the pipe itself is from below, from at depth. So it's, as you can imagine, as it's mixing its way up to the surface, it's also mixing together that cooler water from below. So you actually see a cold surface water depression there. So that's sort of that like darker blue in that middle plot there of September 24, 2015. But then the bottom three plots there are with respect to chlorophyll. So it gives you an indication of phytoplankton or new algal growth due to the nutrients that they were bringing into the system. At this time, too, there was an unprecedented, I believe it was an atmospheric river event, and there was some overflow that happened. So a lot more excessive effluent was dumped within the Santa Monica Bay. We were able to assess it, inform them where, in fact, how far the plume extent went so that they could modify and inform their sort of management strategies within the water. So just success story, but we've also done the same for the Orange County Sanitation District when they had their diversion event in 2012. Next. We also can do the same with stormwater runoff. This is just showing stormwater runoff from 1992 to 2014 using radar images that we have. So showing you sort of the plume extent over time, again, can help with sort of decision-making purposes to see where, in fact, maybe new sampling stations should be enabled. But then also, aside from just seeing where, in fact, these things are, we can also assess what is in that plume itself through other remote sensing capabilities. And if you go to the next one. Wildfire was brought up. I was really excited to hear that. So this is like a perfect catchment to coast issue, right? So here in California, this area is obviously around where, in fact, the Palisades fire also occurred. But we do a lot of things where either we already have the conversations with stakeholder, or we're developing that use case by illustrating what, in fact, our sensors can do. So in this 2018, it was more of a scientific discovery, saying what did we see? What can we contribute so that we can start engagement with stakeholders? So what you're seeing here after the Woolsey fire, it was more of a vegetation burn. But after that, the atmospheric river came through. All that vegetation, burned, charred vegetation, obviously went into the nearby adjacent coastal waterways. Along with it was a lot of bacterial contaminants as well. So realistically, turbidity, those are the blue and the green that you're seeing there sort of surrounding Malibu. That's showing that turbidity itself increased 2 times what it was pre-fire. But also the fecal or bacterial counts increased 5 to 53 times what they were. But what you can see from the top image, I hope, the sort of visible image, you see that sediment, which is associated with that turbidity plume. It also has, aside from, you know, the impact it has upon people and recreation and beach safety, it also impacts the aquatic life within those regions. So we have significant kelp in this area. And the kelp, because obviously it grows through photosynthesis, this turbidity limited its light, it really stunted the recovery of the kelp. And then along came the Eaton fire. So right now we're assessing studies to see how, in fact, has this kelp recovered or will it recover perspective, and trying to identify maybe areas in which we could do more conservation and development for kelp so we can keep this critical ecosystem within California. If you go to the next. So that was a Woolsey. So we developed the use case, and then came the Palisades and Eaton fire. So we're actually part of this post-fire water quality monitoring group. We're providing the remote sensing aspect. Clearly, you guys are one of them, in addition to other city and county agencies, NGOs, and universities. So we're just trying to see how remote sensing can help sort of, again, fill in the gaps, providing this information to the public so that, you know, we can learn more, so that hopefully, you know, we hope these types of wild and urban interface fires don't happen in the future, but we now have a database to really understand what, in fact, could be the implications in the future. If you go to the next, as well as harmful algal blooms. So we mentioned algal blooms. There's you know, algal blooms that are not harmful to people and those that are. What we are actually able to do now with remote sensing technologies is actually distinguish. So we can give you the total. There was a phytoplankton algal bloom, you know, those green algal mats over lakes as well as the ocean. We can tell you that. But also now we can discriminate what, in fact, that is. Is it, in fact, a harmful algal bloom, or is it a non-harmful algal bloom? So the inland hab that you see up there, that's showing you for the Durman Valley Lake, we can actually look at cyanobacteria within that and monitor it over time. And then the bottom plot there for coastal harmful algal blooms, that's showing you different species. So the species in the middle is not necessarily as harmful to people, but the one that's there on the right is. So we can actually see the total and then discriminate it out and see, again, what are the implications for people to help inform beach closures as well as aquatic life, as we get a lot of seal strandings and other issues during these time periods. So just, and again, we have so many things that we can be doing. We're just scratching the surface and telling you a couple. And if you go to the next, thermal anomalies. So we can look at those like marine heat waves, as we saw from the State Water Research Control Board presentation. Terrestrial heating is happening, but we also have the same happening in the water with marine heat waves. So we have sensors that actually tell you what in fact are these marine heat waves, where are they occurring, what's the frequency, duration, et cetera. But we can also do it for things like what we have here. This is a use case for the Diablo nuclear facility power plant, where you can actually see the thermal plume, because it basically takes up the water from the ocean, it runs it through its system, then it dumps out the warmer, effluent water back into the ocean. And you can see this, because they obviously need this for compliance. So we can actually use our sensors to illustrate what in fact, you know, how far this thermal plume went and what it is with respect to the adjacent waters. And if we go next, I promise this is the last one. But again, we could go on and on to tell you tons. But illustrating the last point that Ralph had brought up with respect to the marine carbon dioxide removal. So there's multiple different sort of avenues that have been taken in this regard, whether it's ocean alkalinity, whether it's, you know, introducing new nutrients that could generate a phytoplankton bloom. And then as the phytoplankton die, they're bringing down the carbon to depth, or the carbon capture storage facilities, et cetera. But we have a slew of assets now, whether it's the spaceborne, airborne, and even our models that really can provide test drive scenarios for this. So informing, you know, looking at the past where in fact best conditions could be, so sort of this sighting, if you will, but then also monitoring the response. So providing more of this monitoring, reporting, verification type aspect. Our job is to provide data, higher informed information and knowledge, and provide it to individuals like yourself that actually do more of the decision-making purposes. And we've actually been doing, we have a use case that you see there using one of our amazing modeling assets that we have at JPL called Echo Darwin. It assimilates all our satellite observations, all the in-situ, to provide the most realistic representation of the ocean state to date. And they've been using that to look at MCDR effects. And with that, I'm going to turn it back over to Ralph, who's going to wrap it up. Thank you, guys.
If we can get the next slide, please. It's our last one. Yeah, so we hope you found the presentation today informative. We look forward to the questions that you have. I would like to submit that, again, this we're looking forward to as, or looking at as just a first in a series of meetings, conversations, discussions. Obviously, you know, we work with a team of individuals at JPL who are proud of what we do as a team of scientists and engineers working together to really solve problems and benefit society in general. Even though we put together kind of what we think is of interest, you know, to the board, we would like to extend an invitation to the board to please come and visit us at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. We'd love to show you around, and we'd like to engage in even more in-depth discussions. As Michelle mentioned, we're really only scratching the surface today, but we feel that engaging with you more and giving us the opportunity to bring other scientists and engineers together to engage in more meaningful discussion, I think we'll be able to better maximize the value and utility to key decision makers like yourself. So I'd just like to end by saying thank you very much for your time and attention today.
Thank you. Thank you. That was truly terrific presentation. Thanks very much. So I do have a speaker request, but it's again for Ms. Magana of CDFW. I don't see what she would. I see Jenny shaking her head. I guess not then. All right. Okay, but in that case, and there are no other virtual contributors. Okay. So with that, in that case, let's go to questions from board members. Board Member Mendez, would you like to go first?
Sure. Thank you again for this very informative presentation. Great to learn of all the amazing work you're doing in the public interest. Quite fond of the work from afar. I've been a visiting scientist with the National Center for Atmospheric Research for a couple of years, so never participated with JPL, but would love to take you up on that opportunity to visit your facility in Altadena. My question is, have the recent federal cuts been an impact to some of the work that you're doing? I know a lot of the federal agencies to the universities, which I work at, have had severe funding cutbacks. So I was wondering if it's impacting some of this public interest work that you're working on.
Yeah, thank you very much for your question, Board Member Mendez. So maybe about a year ago, you know, we first heard about the president's budget request for this government fiscal year. And there was a lot of concern at JPL, NASA, and the community in general. I do think that due process took its course, where the House of Representatives and the Senate did an outstanding job recognizing that science research is important. And through the appropriations process, they reinstated a lot of the funding for NASA. Now, with each administration, there's obviously a set of priorities, and the current set of priorities today are Moon and Mars. You know, as you probably heard in the news, you know, Artemis 2, you know, they're looking forward to sending astronauts around the moon and eventually, you know, having boots on the moon within the president's administration. So I would submit that with our new NASA administrator, that he's working within his set of capabilities, his set of resources to not only realize the vision of this administration, but also make sure that science, especially earth science, remains important. And there's always an ebb and flow of priorities. I do feel that the key decision makers within NASA and within JPL do sincerely believe that there's value. And for a lot of us at JPL, especially our scientists, you know, you have the best minds in the country thinking up these fantastic ideas and looking at the data that hasn't been looked at in certain ways before. So I just want to leave you with that. Even though there's this ebb and flow, resources may come and go, or maybe priorities change, we remain committed to not just science and research, but really providing the value and utility for this data application. So regardless of what may get thrown our way, if you will, we're focused, we're dedicated, and want to be contributing members of this community that, you know, we are part of.
Good. It's great to hear that a lot of that funding had been restored. And while you don't call it climate change-related work, it's definitely within that work. But I love how you emphasize a lot of the projects here today that had a public health focus, which is quite important for the work that we do and many of the stakeholders that we collaborate with. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you very much. Echoing my thanks for your presentation. I'm a huge JPL and NASA fan, so I've been fangirling over here the whole time. My day job, when I'm not here, I run the Climate and Wildfire Institute, which is the way that I think stay most closely informed of your work. So I have a couple of specific questions for you in looking at your remote capabilities and everything that can be tracked from LIDAR and satellites and the like. I would be really interested to know if you have data on, I saw you had carbon sinks, I'm assuming wildfire risk, right? Key watersheds in terms of water quality, supply, biodiversity, all of that. And then looking at fuel treatment efficacy. Is that, like, do you layer maps to be able to sort of see where our attention and resources are going versus where maybe they need to go?
Thank you for the question. are you talking specifically about wildfire?
Yeah, wildfire, but backing up, in this state, our wildfire mitigation and fuels treatments happen where there is enough staffing and enough resources, right? And isn't often linked to things like carbon sinks or even risk, which is something that obviously we're all trying to change. And so I'm wondering if these are tools that JPL has at its fingertips that maybe could be elevated to these sorts of decisions.
Sure. Relative to, we didn't get a chance to talk about a fair bit of this, but relative to wildfire and wildfire risk, we have capabilities that can characterize the landscape in terms of its vegetation in several respects. One is just the amount of biomass in the vegetation, trees versus other things, how dense it is and so forth. And we monitor disturbances in that. And it's really interesting. If you look at the fire sequence of things over the last 20 years, you can see puzzle pieces being, this was burned, and then this was burned, and then another thing was burned. And the thing that hadn't burned for a long time is this just segment where Eaton Canyon fire happened.
Wow.
So we monitor the vegetation, its disturbance. We also have capabilities, the kind of things that Michelle was showing off in terms of characterizing the ocean and water characteristics, same thing over the land surface and vegetation. We can almost pick out different tree types from aircraft. So we can characterize the vegetation type and its structure and its biomass that would help characterize wildfire loads, wildfire fuel loads. Does that help?
Yeah, absolutely. And do you do that for, obviously, the chaparral and scrubland?
Yeah, we can do it across the landscape.
All right.
We did just launch a satellite, over a $1 billion satellite called NISAR. Oh, you know about it. It's on your NASA ISRO, meaning the Indian Space Research Organization, SAR, Synthetic Aperture Radar. It's a very expensive, ambitious mission that was launched about 6 months ago and just coming online. That's a state-of-the-art radar to really do this kind of thing in terms of characterizing biomass and disturbances.
Yeah.
Everything from forest fire disturbance to earthquake disturbance to land moving up and down. And it's the new Cadillac on the block for that kind of activity, and we're really anxious to start utilizing that data.
That's great.
I might have missed something. Did you? Yeah.
So, I mean, we are very good in specific disciplines, right? So, oceans, atmosphere, et cetera. But we've really been making concerted efforts in the last couple of years, probably even 5 to 10, looking at interdisciplinary aspects, like what you're saying. So all these products, how are they all work together? How do they all couple? And using additional assets to compile them all together, whether it's, through the modeling assets that Duane briefly mentioned, and I might have mentioned as well, to now, through AI and ML and these foundational models or even digital twins. So we really are starting sort of thinking more in that holistic space of how these things all couple. As for products, because I did hear, maybe my mind went there because I think about it all the time. I think that's something that really needs to be a discussion with a stakeholder, because we could develop a product that combines all these different things to provide a severity index or risk maps, but really having that, again, discussion that this is something that you want and need, and what in fact those levels would be and layers and what would constitute a threshold of this would be moderate, this would be high. I think that's sort of the next level that we really want to be going, sort of this higher level knowledge or wisdom, if you will, that is really sort of the next level and next step that JPL, but also NASA, is really providing to get to that earth science to action perspective. So yes, and we would love to have more conversations to take it to that next step.
Happy to discuss more with that.
Can I add one more thing that I failed to?
Course.
So I said that we had assets to characterize sort of the vegetation type, the vegetation mass, whether there's been a disturbance on it, but we also can actually sense the amount of water, vegetation water content, mm-hmm. or the amount of evapotranspiration that is happening on the landscape to understand how much water availability or not there is. And so we can characterize that intersection as well, which helps us understand where, dry areas might be ready for wildland fire.
That's great. We're working on a chaparral strategy, so we should connect. But I digress. Getting back to the Eaton Fire area, I also saw that you're monitoring contaminant runoff, which is great. I know that some of the residents in that area whose homes did not burn, but of course were permeated with smoke and the like, have struggled to understand what their homes are now contaminated with. And unfortunately, the access to testing that they have isn't always covered by insurance, since their home didn't burn down, or if it doesn't have extreme enough smoke damage. And the testing that is available right now is really focused on lead and arsenic. And so I'm wondering, do you have the capability to track contaminant diaspora, whether it's vapor, runoff, or particulate, and actually tell what the makeup, what the content of those contaminants specifically are.
I'll give a try here, but my colleagues can correct me. I think that's where a bleeding edge of our capability right now. We've started to recently put up what we call imaging spectrometers. So they take a picture of the landscape when like 270 wavelengths across the spectrum. And from that, you can almost see the molecular elements at the surface, you know, the sun hitting them, and then you can tell sort of what molecules there based on the reflection of what the return is. And so we're just starting to learn how to take that data and actually characterize the chemical constituents at the surface. But it either from aircraft, it has to be, or from the satellite, it would be a room, a sample this big of a room, for example. So it'd be a mixed signal, potentially.
Yeah.
From an aircraft, the same technology can almost identify the size of this table. And so you start to get more a purer signal, but we're really learning to do that. For example, from the Eaton fire, I've seen figures that show the fraction of ash in a given scene. So, for example, this house is completely burned. It's almost 100% ash. Or this one's partly burned, and so it's like 50%. I've seen things like that, yeah. For example. I don't know. Anything you want to add to that?
So to Duane's point, I mean, most of our satellites do get sort of a larger scale, where I think a lot of, you know, community members, including myself, so I was up by the Upper Hastings Ranch fire, and my house had to be fully remediated, and I have two young children, so I think about this all the time. Thankfully, my insurance was much better than others, and then again, the benefit of good and bad. I wish it never happened, but if it did, what better place to happen than an area in which you have all these amazing, you know, R1 universities, Caltech, have JPL. People were going out, their house burned down at JPL, and they're going out in their spare time to collect samples, soil samples, to sort of push the next level and be like, we need to be doing this. So aside from that, but I think we're sort of limited in sort of the space-time scale, as Duane's mentioning, as well as, you know, the sensors that we're putting up talk about PM 2.5, right, which is what's harmful to us. But, like, what's in that PM 2.5? We have some upcoming missions, such as Maya, that will allow that speciation of what, in fact, is in the PM 2.5. But right now that has not launched yet. But we can do some things here and there by partnering with institutions, or, as Duane mentioned, getting more at the airborne level to bring it down to more of the parcel ID or parcel perspective of homes. But it's definitely something, again, use cases that then we get really engaged and excited to do mighty things and do the innovation to help in the future. But yeah.
That's great. And I'm glad your house is okay. One last question. Sea level rise. You hear all the time in the news how the glaciers are melting much faster than science was predicting, and all sorts of other sort of prediction spreads. What are you seeing with sea level rise, and what can we expect in Los Angeles? You know, we talk about centimeters and inches at a time, but what does that actually mean for coastal flooding?
Gosh, yeah, it's almost like you were paid to ask this question, because I could get really excited about this. I really do think this is one of the greatest arcs of capability and decision support that NASA and JPL has contributed to, because 30 years ago we put up the first working altimeter, which is a radar that starts from satellite, bounces a radar off the surface, and tells how high the ocean surface is to within a fraction of a centimeter. And so now we have a 30-year record of that, and it's a long-standing collaboration with the French Space Agency and other space agencies. So we have a long 30-year record of what's happening to the global oceans, and it clearly indicates that sea level's been rising over the last 30 years, you know, about this much globally, all over the world. And then there's discrimination about where it's higher and lower. And then on top of that, with models and other, that GRACE satellite that we just showed that talked about the water, and it can measure pretty precisely how much water is melting off the ice sheets. And so we know, for example, out of that, say, 10 centimeters that have been rising over the last 30 years, how much of that's contributed by melting ice sheets around the world and snow melting, adding water, and then how much of that is just the ocean heating up and expanding. And so we can discriminate at that level. And by knowing that much process level detail, I mean, the community and JPL and NASA has models that provide pretty good predictions in the, you know, next 10, 20, 30 years. As those get put into documents, for example, in California, in the state and the nation, it show basically the, you know, a pretty good estimate of what sea level has been doing, a very good estimate, and what it's going to do in the future, at least in the next few decades. And pretty precise process knowledge about really crazy things, like if this much of Greenland melts in this part of Greenland, how it will affect sea level all around the globe. We have colleagues that have done some amazing work in this kind of area. And then how much the land and the ocean change in response to that. You know, this is pretty interesting. If Greenland melts, the water goes into the ocean. And relatively speaking, the water around Greenland goes down because there's not as much gravitational attraction of the water to Greenland because it's lost mass. Wow. And so folks have articulated, you know, how much it goes elsewhere versus right around Greenland. So we can map out that level of precision and response to the global or regional sea level problem in association with this ice sheet versus another ice sheet melting.
Unbelievable.
Does that answer your question?
It does. And what can LA expect as impacts from this sea level rise over, say, the next decade?
Yeah, I'd have to see the quantitative predictions, but it'd be probably on the order of centimeters per decade over the next. Does that sound about right? I think.
Okay.
But we can give you a really precise projection of that if you're interested.
Yeah, awesome.
Okay.
Mind-blowing, huh? Okay, that's it for me.
Oh, this has been such a great presentation. It gets me excited in terms of the data that's available that can be utilized today. And so one of the things I wanted to ask about, well, to piggyback on the sea level rise discussion, I think you should reach out to the County of Marin. They are really struggling right now in terms of sea level rise issues and planning issues, et cetera. And so could you utilize your data that is very impartial, you know? And so, and I like the fact that you lend this impartial data analysis. You don't advocate for conclusions, that you provide it for us to make our decisions and use it to make wiser decisions. And so one of the things that I wanted to put on kind of on your radar as well too, as recycled water becomes more and more prevalent, a reverse osmosis concentrate and the disposal of that is going to be more of an issue as we look towards disposing much of that concentrate into the ocean. And what are the long-term effects of that as the concentrate becomes more and more concentrated and there's more and more inputs throughout the whole Southern California region? And so that might be something that you can bring data to the table in regards to that if you haven't already been engaged in discussions there. And then you heard earlier about all of the discussions surrounding the Bay Delta, what's going on there in terms of the balance between water rights, water supply needs, and environmental water flows as well. And so I'm just wondering if you have done any work in terms of looking at establishing more in-depth physical types of models that can react with different changes in infrastructure in that area, because as you heard, sites, you know, is in the process of getting designed and permitted as well. What is the ultimate impact going to be once that, if that project goes forward, you know, how is that going to affect water supply, since much of what happens in the Delta affects us in Southern California as well, too. And I don't know if you had your sights set on Colorado River and all of the issues in regards to what's going on there. But data for that negotiation, which I think is heading towards an impasse right now, could be very, very helpful. And one thing I do want to, as you heard earlier, LA County Public Works was here in terms of talking about the Safe Clean Water Plan. And if they haven't already reached out to you, I would encourage you to reach out to them to talk about the initial watershed plans and how JPL data could inform those plans as well in terms of outlining future opportunities within those watershed areas. And also, also encourage you to keep abreast on what's going on with the scientific advisory panel that's being put together by LA County as well, too, and how JPL could either sit or advise that panel. And really, I'm glad to see that you're doing a lot of work on harmful algal blooms. Those are very concerning both in our region and both in the Northern California region. But I was wondering if you have any data on invasive mussels as well. As all of our water systems are getting connected, invasive mussels are traveling all over our watersheds. And so, but if you could speak to that, that would be interesting.
There's so much you brought up that I want to speak to, but for that one, can we detect the mussels themselves? No. Not right now. How about that? We could design something together. But one thing that we can do is understand more of what they thrive in, the type of environment, and we have a lot of, obviously, various environmental observations that can really help in providing that this sort of seems to be prime areas in which they would sort of be overtaking or going to. You should be going out and sampling here and taking management-informed decisions. So not the mussels themselves, but the environments that they might like and the thresholds of temperature, salinity, et cetera, that they would thrive in.
No, and that would be great because then you could take preventive measures.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly so. And also, you know, make projections. If temperature or salinity is going to be changing by X, these are prime areas in which they might be moving to then really protect the native sort of mussels or shellfish within that area.
Mm-hmm. Great. And thank you again for coming today, and look forward to attending one of your visits and tours and so to learn more. Thank you.
Well, my colleagues have asked all the questions that I was going to ask, so I think it's said that at one time Churchill was at the end of a line of bunch of speakers, and when it came to him, he got up and he said, well, everything that needed to be said has been said, but it hasn't been said by everybody. So then he launched into his talk. So you'll be relieved that I'm not going to do that. I just want to really express sincere, sincere thanks for coming and talking to us today. It's been really a revelation to listen to you. I've been to JPL. I did it when I was when I headed LADWP, and we actually signed the memorandum with the then head of the JPL when Villaraigosa was mayor. So very much looking forward to coming back. And I think I know that you're dealing with LADWP on some things and so on, but you know, when you think of all of the water agencies across the state of California that you know in many instances are kind of traveling blind because they don't know what it is, you know, the treasure that resides there in Pasadena. And I think it's we should all do our best to let them know everything that you can do, and you know, may you long work, prosper, and shine the truth when there are so many forces out there that would deprive us of that truth. Thank you so much. Thanks. All right. So next, we're going to this will be anticlimactic, but we're going to adjourn to closed session to talk about litigation and stuff like that. So, Adriana, would you tell us
yes. about our closed session? Yes, we'll be going into closed session to discuss item 12K, People of the State of California, XREL, California Regional Water Quality Control Board, Los Angeles Region, versus Prologis et al.
Okay. Thank you. We're adjourned and we're not coming back. Okay.